And welcome. Oh, we're getting better at that. To another properly distanced remote Zoomcastic 8-4 play podcast. I am your host, Mark Games McDonald, coming at you from a very rainy Tokyo, rainy season.
That's right.
One might almost call it. But with a good crew and a special guest coming later. But starting off, let's see, pole position. That is one Mr. Roy Daikon Blakely.
That's me.
Daikon artist, Daikon sprite, Daikon master.
Yeah.
One might say almost. You're back into making some games?
Yeah, actually, both my girlfriend and I are working on our own projects right now. Hers is a bit of a platformer, and she's kind of started to work on it over the weekend. And she was throwing it together in Unity and wanted just some placeholder art. So she was like, why don't you draw me a daikon? Because one of the mechanics is pulling daikon out of the ground.
It looked very Mario 2.
Super Mario 2, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe. I can't tell all the Marios apart.
That didn't come up? You weren't you mean Mario 2.
Wait, okay, so I realized the joke you were about to make was all the Marios look the same. That's literally the one that doesn't look like fucking anything else in the series.
Isn't that the one where they're a little bit taller?
It's the one where they're pulling vegetables out of the ground the whole game.
Oh, really? I honestly didn't know that was a thing in it.
Oh, yeah.
Have you not played that game?
I played whatever...
Get off this podcast! Go! Bad Roy. Bad Roy.
Well, that's just I'm really bummed out for you because you're really missing out on a drug trip of a game.
Maybe a did. Was it ever on Game Boy?
No. Game Boy Advance it was. It was.
Was it?
One of the.
It was one of the Super Mario something or others. What they call it? Advance.
Oh, yeah. The numbers got so complicated, right? It was Super Mario Brothers Advance 4, Super Mario Brothers 3, or what? The numbers got all mixed up. But Roy, you might also know it as Super Mario Brothers USA.
That's what it's called in Japan.
No, nothing. I got nothing.
Roy, it is.
The good news is you can download it on your Switch.
Yeah, I could.
Roy, I think you will be surprised. People can go to your Twitter feed if they want to see some footage of this new game in action that you're making. You might get a DMCA takedown from Nintendo because they do listen to this podcast, in fact, but it is very
or 7-Up. Right? I was wondering, what's the deal with Cool Spot? Yes. Is he a Unity asset or something?
No, actually, Sarah's just a big Cool Spot fan, so she made Cool Spot be the player.
That's actually supposed to be Cool Spot. Okay.
It is Cool Spot, yeah. Wow. And I was like, wait, what?
Okay.
I see, it makes sense now.
Excited to see more of that, Roy, as you guys get it worked out. But
It's mostly Sarah. I'm working on another thing that's I haven't talked about it yet, but it's just a really tiny... game it in this web-based program called Bitsy, where it's it's extremely simple, very simple tools. I tried starting with Pico 8 for making games, but that was even that is a little too advanced for me. This one is no coding at all. It's just kind of drop downs, and you could draw simple pixel art and stuff. So
what kind of game are you? Give us a genre if you will.
It's I guess maybe an adventure game. You just go through different rooms in this bunker and talk to people and you have one job that you have to do. On each floor you have to find something. That's pretty much it. It's very simple.
Like a old school a LucasArts adventure style game type thing?
No,
because or older school text adventure with
somewhere just slightly above text adventure, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Nice. On. Maybe work on that pitch a little bit. sell the sizzle, Roy, not the steak.
Okay.
Speaking of sizzle and steak, John, his name is Luca.
I'm glad that wasn't Tina.
Ricciardi.
Hi. What did you call me?
Her name is Luca.
His name.
Well, that's
he's a bro.
That's a twist, but the
Right, I know.
My
the song.
Name is Luca. Actually, I guess it is in the song. You have been a huge Edie Brickell fan since I've known you, and it seems only apt that finally you get to pay tribute to your fandom in the form of new life, of animal life, of a new kitten.
Right.
Congratulations. Aw. Yes.
Yes. We like thought about his name. We were trying to figure out a name for him and like nothing was coming up and he almost got named Koopy after Koopy Domine, you know, the, like that like 5-year old can, I mean, 5-year old as in like 5-year olds eat it. 5-year olds and me, that candy for kids in Japan. That's like super old school, super famous.
I like that name.
And I love that shit.
I would have thought that's like a chibi Koopa nickname though, especially from you. I would have been like, okay.
Yeah, no, we just stopped in the candy store that day because we happened to be walking by and I was like, Koopy. And we were like, ooh, but yeah, we ended up calling him Luca.
If you had named him that, I genuinely would have thought you'd named him after mayonnaise.
Mm. Is Koopy a brand of mayonnaise?
It sounds like Koopy.
I see.
Yeah. It sounds like pillow talk for Koopa, which is what I would have assumed and never confirmed it with you because I would have been too embarrassed to bring it up and I would have been like, oh, it's a...
Part of the problem stems back to bad localization in probably like 1950 or something, because like on the box it's spelled K-U-P-P-Y, which like doesn't, if you say that to a Westerner, it's like cuppy, what? Yeah. Like, yeah. So we were like, okay, never mind. But almost.
So why Luca?
Noah liked it. We were just naming names and she came up with it and we're like, yeah, that's cool. Works cool.
I choose to believe that it's because of Chrono Trigger.
It's not Luca with two C's. It's one C. So. Sorry.
Therefore, invalid.
Thought of that too. I wouldn't have gone with that if it was Chrono Trigger. I don't want to name it after like a too nerdy.
You watch
video
your
game
mouth. Thing. She's my favorite.
No, it's fine. But I'm not going to name life after a video game, like if possible.
Smash cut to his
next cat, John Madden.
Yeah. How is he then getting along with your existing cat?
Great. They like, yeah, nobody warned me about, like, I read about, I guess, as you would do if you're going to get a kitten. I read a ton of shit and I watched like 1,000 YouTube videos about like how to introduce cats to each other and how to take care of kittens and blah, blah, blah. But like, I was not prepared for like how much pure burning energy this cat has. He is like constant 120 miles an hour all the time. He's just learned how to climb shit. So like as of today, he just suddenly decided, like out of nowhere, just suddenly decided to start climbing walls and climbing curtains. And he's all over the place now.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. He's like adorable. He's really affectionate. But like our other cat is really chill. And according to Noah, because he was her cat before I knew her. Like he was chill as a baby too. He was not like crazy hyper like this. So I may be in for a monster. I don't know. We'll see. But
I mean, I love it. All it's been cats great. Mellow. I mean, if you somehow magically got a cat that stayed like a kitten, that would be.
I mean, they say up to like 8 months or so, they're going to be like this, but like, he doesn't even stop to listen or anything. Like, you know, he's just like doing his thing. He's affectionate for like the 10 minutes after he eats. It's like when he finally is like, got what he wants and chills and like, he's licking my face and it's the greatest thing ever. And then he's back to just like a motorcycle, like burning around the place. So. It's fun though.
Speaking of motorcycles burning around the place, there's a lot of those out where you're moving. That's Tina.
Oh, that
Cytastic Carter. Tama bound.
Yeah. 1 month of Tokyo life left.
Yeah. So you got a new apartment, getting a new apartment in the.
Yeah, it's all very fresh. We just signed some stuff in the last couple of days, so it's all very new.
What will this do to your commute if and when coming back to the office becomes a thing? Like how deep? Saitama goes deep.
Saitama is weirdly shaped because it's like, for people who don't know, it's like horizontal and long and just stuck up against Tokyo for most of it. So when someone says in Saitama, they could mean any point within like a 2-hour drive. Like it's a big old mystery.
Yeah, old school listeners who remember JJ would know about Saitama a bit, because JJ lived in like the ass end of Saitama. Like it was really far out.
Yeah, which lives, end is it? I think we should say. He's back.
No comment.
He's back there now. Yeah, he had a 2-hour commute. Like,
no, not that level. I would not have agreed to that in the first place. So I'm a little bit spoiled in that I've never had a commute to 8-4. So I won't notice the difference.
Yeah. Right. Tina's a corona baby.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a weird time.
The age of COVID.
But my commute would have been, this adds 15 minutes on the train, and that's all.
Oh, okay.
And it's the same train. There's no transfer. So it's really not terrible.
And you get way more apartment for less money out there.
Yeah. Well, we get, right? for lower rent, we get a whole extra room and permission to own pets, which if you're listening and you know anything about renting in Japan, that's a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, it's super rare. Did you like go apartment hunting like after all this stuff, after all the COVID stuff happened?
Yeah. We had started looking in the spring, and every time we found a place that we liked, it had already been taken, because that's like peak moving time.
Right.
So if you look at an apartment and go and take a shit and come back and it's already gone, like, it's impossible. We started looking again in the last couple of weeks, because working from home has really made it clear to me that I need a space to work in that doesn't have someone on a TV 2 feet away from me.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's making not spoiling Death Stranding for myself very, very difficult.
Oh boy. Yeah. I've heard anecdotally, actually, that a lot of the prices outside of Tokyo are going up right now, because a lot of people are doing what you're doing, which is like, well, fuck it. If I don't need to be this close to anything, I'm going to go place for more space. And so, friend of the show, Alex Smith, was saying that down in, Kamakura, that all of that stuff is going sky high, because people always, like, people who live in Tokyo have this fantasy of living down in Kamakura near the water and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So
anyway, it actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what happened to us, because I had firmly been in the position of like, I'm not leaving Tokyo for at least another 10 years. I want to live in the city before I leave. Da, da, da. And now it's, I spend literally all my time in my house. I want to have a comfy house.
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah, we got a letter yesterday in the mail, and from our real estate people, which is, you know, very uncommon. And we were like, uh-oh, what the hell is this? Like, are we getting kicked out or something? Turns out they were like, oh, hey, we forgot to send the contract, you know, when you moved last year. Here it is, sorry. But like, in the like short span of like getting that and before we opened it, I was thinking to myself, like, yeah, like if I had to move now, I would just move like to a giant place 2 hours away, because it doesn't matter anyway. Like, might as well just live in like a mansion, like in the middle of nowhere. I bet you like if this stuff doesn't go away soon, more and more people are going to be doing that.
Might be good for the city overall, honestly.
I know. Yeah, get the hell out.
Absolutely. Spread it out a little bit. Speaking of spreading it out, finally,
whoa,
in the anchor position.
All right.
Speaking role this week.
I am.
That's right. You are.
All right.
As your big,
called up
as your big birthday gift for the whole podcast. That's Gabe, big 3-0.
Yeah.
Adelion.
Hello. Yeah. I'm turning 30 on Saturday.
That's right. Oh. Which is probably as you're listening to this, cause Japan is one day ahead if you downloaded it on the first day of this podcast. So, please wish Gabe a happy birthday online if you could find him. Which is not easy.
I'll read the 8-4 Twitter comments.
You can make sure you listen to the end of the podcast. Stick with us, because we all say our handles at the end.
Yeah,
so you know, that's when you'll know.
Maybe he'll have one by then.
Yeah, Gabe, you need to unlock your business. And also, what if listeners want to? Can listeners take part in your Zoom? In your Zoom.
Mazumikai?
Your Zoomikai? You want to give out that URL?
That's probably a recipe for disaster.
Oh, man.
I mean, that sounds like a great way to start a new decade to me.
It definitely does.
I think that would be fun.
I mean,
we need to get Graham out here.
The link is out there for the select few. I can't control it at that point.
Oh, okay. Well, don't say anything. Just blink twice. And I will send it out on my Twitter feed to everybody.
No, what needs to happen is 8-4 account needs to tweet it out and then immediately delete it, so only people who have notifications on can come.
Nice.
Ooh.
That'd be cool.
And we should mention Graham. Pour one out for him. He's still alive, though. Just pour one out for him. He's not on this podcast this week.
That's right.
He's busy with stuff. So
secret stuff.
Stuff happens. Stuff happens in Animal Crossing, which we don't have too many games to talk about. This time we're still playing Last of Us 2. Roy, how many hours in are you?
I think I'm probably close to 10.
Okay. This is going to be just me on this next spoiler cast, I think.
I really have to be in the right frame of mind to load that game up.
I hear you.
You know, and it's rare that I find it. It's usually only like if it's like Sunday afternoon and the sun's out, then I'm like, okay, I'm ready to go down this dark path. But
I get it.
You know, weeknights when I'm already drained, I don't have it in me.
Sure.
Mark did mention that it's rainy season, which is pretty rare. It hasn't happened in 3 years. I mean, we really didn't have a rainy season last year or the year before. We had two very weird Junes. Like last year it was like 90 and sunny the whole month, and then the year before it just like was weird. And one of them there was a bunch of typhoons and everything. But like this year it's like proper old school. When I first moved here, Japan, like raining all day every day for the entire month. So
and it's actually I would have thought
that's a good time to play. Yeah, it is cool actually. Cool as in not disgustingly hot and sweaty like it usually is. But I would have thought that's a perfect reason to play.
Sweaty and gross. Like rainy season somehow manages to still be. You're right. It would be hotter and worse heat index wise. But it's been
last year was awful.
Pretty miserable in terms of just muggy and like walking outside and just like. Like 90-something% humidity, Tokyo summer awfulness. But anyway,
that plus a pandemic is plenty of time to play video games.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it couldn't be more apropos for The Last of Us in a sense because Last of Us very overcast and rainy, pandemic, etc.
Right.
Anyway, I won't go through and say how many hours everybody's been playing, but the idea is to talk about
it
next podcast, just so that it's not.
Mark is setting deadlines.
Too late. Yeah, it might just be me and Gabe, but we will do that. Or Tina or anyone else who doesn't care, who's quit or doesn't care about spoilers.
So my I gave it a couple hours and I'm really just like, I'm not equipped to deal with this. I can't do it. It's the perfect level of scary where I'm like, I think I can do it. And then I start playing and I'm like, no, I cannot. So right. I do want to know what happens. I want to see what's up. So I am going to watch a supercut of it.
Okay,
so
good.
I will be present.
Why don't you do that? Yeah.
I'll be present to talk about it, but I won't have any strong opinions on like gameplay mechanics and that kind of thing.
Sure, sure. But until that discussion next episode, most of the games, the few that we've been playing are kind of just evergreen. I mean, in fairness, not a ton of stuff has happened. There have been a couple updates. Monster Hunter had an update. We'll talk about that in news that just happened as we are recording this, so we haven't really played it yet. Roy, you going to play that?
I haven't started Monster Hunter again since this whole thing happened, but it's been kind of like on my mind that I might jump back in.
Okay.
And this would be a very good reason to jump back in.
It's a good excuse to do that, but something else that got updated that people have been playing, Animal Crossing, what was it, July 3rd? Just about a week ago.
Yes.
Got its first, I guess, of two summer updates. Another one's happening next month. They haven't really talked about what that update is. This update, what was it? Diving and swimming, basically, was the big?
Yeah, they've added swimming, so you can go into the water, which then opened up a whole new category of thing that you can collect in the collect-a-thon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a whole different... Not, it's not a new section of the museum, but it's a new category within the museum.
So, any good? Tell me about it. Exciting.
Oh, it's great.
You guys like playing more than you were playing as a result of it?
I'm still playing every single day, which is I think pretty good. Like 4 months, I started to feel here's how it goes. Like a couple of weeks ago, I had a day where I didn't like turn the game on until like 8 p.m. or something. And that was like the first time. And, you know, that's when you know you're like, oh, the relationship is starting to sour or whatever, you know, like, and then, but then, you know, right as that was starting to happen every day, not only did this update come out, but July happened. And every time the months change, there's reason to get excited again because like new bugs show up and new fish. And July is just like, like they just let the, like the whole bug kingdom out or whatever. There's like 30 new bugs or something, a bunch of beetles and things. And so I started playing more, but I haven't done too much with the water stuff. Like I've gone around and it's fun to swim and things and like collect stuff, but like I haven't spent a ton of time of it. I'm actually just having fun going around chasing new bugs and fish. Which probably sounds so boring if you don't play the game. But like,
I mean, that's all the game is, pretty much, in a nutshell anyway, right? So having new ones of those, I guess, makes sense.
It's fun because it makes the environment completely different from what you're used to. The first couple of days after new bugs come out especially, you're walking around and you see a movement you've never seen before, or you hear a weird sound and you don't know what it is. And it makes it very exciting. And like one of the new bugs scared the shit out of me the first time I saw it, like genuinely made me jump. And not because it's like a horrifying monster or whatever. It's just the world that I was completely used to exactly as it was completely different.
Right.
For that fraction of a second. It was really exciting.
There's also this app that came out. I don't know if this has been out for a while and I just found out about it or if it just came out, but everyone's been talking about it. It's called ACNH Guide. It's obviously not official, but it's a really well-made app that has like, it keeps track of all your shit in the game for you, where at this point in the game, it's kind of helpful to have that because it's been enough months now that like, there's a lot of stuff going on. Like which songs do I have in case I want to buy the new one from the shop or whatever, you know, which bugs have I caught, which fish have I caught? And this app will like, let you track all that stuff. And then like, it'll just tell you, like, if you open it, it'll tell you like right now what bugs are catchable, like at this time of day, you know, this month. And it's really handy. So I started using that and that actually got me into the game a little more because like, it's like a way of, it makes it a little easier to know that there's stuff out there I can do.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, I'm digging it.
Is that a paid app or is that a free app?
It's a free app. It has ads in it, but it maybe there's a paid version, but it's really, it's not obtrusive or anything. It's really nicely designed too.
And so you're going through and manually saying the stuff that you get as you get it for it to keep track, right? Yeah. I was thinking that's really interesting. Like Destiny was the same way when it first came out, that privately made apps or internet plugins, those were automatic, which was amazing. And they had functionality even within the game, but it was way better and way ahead than what was officially being done. And really contributing to people like their stickiness or what have you, like the amount that they would play the game and whatever, way ahead of where the official app, which I think eventually ended up catching up with it, was, seems like still something that like games have a lot still to figure out there, like in terms of like the third screen, or wait, I guess that'd be the second screen, like experience, how the app can interact with the game and kind of add to it and stuff like that. But
I wish there was more of that. I mean, there must be, maybe there's data or something that says not enough people utilize it to make it worth the effort. But like, for example, another game that I've been playing a bunch lately, because it's kind of like my comfort food, is Dragon Quest X, the MMO on Switch. And
oh, you're playing that again?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm playing a ton of it lately. Wow. I'm actually really into it as for the first time, like, or I should say, like, I haven't been this into it since it first came out. Like, I'm actively moving the story forward.
Forever ago, right? For the Wii, was it? Originally?
It first came out on the Wii, Now I'm playing it on Switch. But that has an app, and the app on that is actually great. It's better than the Final Fantasy XIV app, like, a lot better. Like, you can actually do a lot of the sort of busy work that you do in the game on the app if you want to. Like, I can sell shit at the bazaar on my phone, or I can, you know, get certain items and do these like little mini things or sign up for quests and stuff. And like, I would love to have more of that, because like, then I can make use of the time that I'm away from the game to just do the busy work that I don't want to waste time on playing the game, you know.
Do you still have your house, your Dragon Quest house? Is it still
I do, it's still there. Yeah, it's still in like section 8-4 of like some town, like
This is good though, because you still have to pay every month, right?
I've been paying since the first month.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, and I know I don't need to be, and I would have quit if it was any other game, but like I actually wanted to support this game from the beginning, being like a big Dragon Quest fan, and I was kind of hoping that it would actually maybe come to the West someday, but it never did.
That still surprises me that never came, especially now it's on, you know, modern consoles and stuff. But anyway.
And it's good. It's good.
So can I ask a question about this app and its use? And I'm not trying to start a fight, but...
Ooh, please do. Please do.
So John has had some strong feelings about the right and the wrong way to play Animal Crossing when it comes to time traveling.
Right.
But you're looking
the wrong way. The wrong way being time traveling. Right.
Right. Yes. So you're looking at an app that's telling you all the answers for you to just go and get them. I don't even need to ask my question. I think I've presented
what I'm trying to get at. Maybe less of a question and more of a
the accusation rests.
Yeah, you know, there are some people who get excited by like not. I'm not making fun. I'm serious. Like my girlfriend's one of them. Like there are some people who don't want to know like what fish are out there or what bugs or whatever. They want to be surprised. But like I've been playing Animal Crossing for like 15 years or whatever now. Like it's not a surprise anymore. So like. I'm going to keep track of that. I actually did keep track of the songs, for example. Like, I want to get all the KK songs, so I was keeping track. And it's a pain in the ass to do that yourself. So, like, I'm not actually using all the features of the app. Maybe there's some stuff in there that I would find offensive. But for keeping track, like a checklist, it's great. And what about that is – are you talking about the part how
no,
it tells
no,
you
– No, I have no problem with using it as a – I don't have a problem with any of this.
No, it sounds like you have a problem.
This is devil's advocacy corner.
I don't have a problem with doing any of this stuff. I have a problem with being a hypocrite about it.
I don't understand. I'm not cheating. There is no cheating going on. The app is not giving me free money. Well, the app is not fucking up the economy or anything.
It's a closed economy that has no one else has any influence on the economy on your island except you?
Yes.
Yeah, I get it. I see. I mean, I think keeping track of stuff in the app is totally...
Oh, that sounds super useful. I just mean the thing of like, here's
when it's
what's
telling
new,
you,
here's how to get it.
That does seem like a little gray area to me.
I mean, yeah, I'm not going to like super defend it, but just for the record, like when that new stuff first comes out, like I usually don't look up anything. I'll play for like 3 or 4 days and try to catch whatever I can. And then it starts to slow down and then you start to not catch them. And then it's like, okay,
what am I missing?
You know, I'm missing this fish. How do I get it? Sort of thing. Okay. So like, that's probably the best time to use it. And that is where I'm at now too. I've only got like 3 or 4 bugs and maybe two or three fish that I haven't got in the game. So, and it's not because I use the app to get them.
Right.
Tina,
we'll let you off the hook. Don't worry. I'm letting you off the hook. any other games that people have been playing, checking in on? Final Fantasy 14, you guys are both still playing that, John. Didn't they release an update or no? What's
kind of
coming
on,
out? It's coming out next month.
Update's coming out.
Next month. Got delayed. August, okay, yeah. We'll talk about that in news. Tina, you sticking with Ring Fit?
Not in the slightest.
No.
There's two points to that. Point one, it feels a lot like one of those educational plays you would watch at school, which would be like, hey, kids, you know, obeying the law is cool. And it's like trying to make exercise cool and edgy with a weird boss that I don't know. It feels lame while I'm playing it. So it's like,
can't you not play the adventure part though and just do the exercise?
Can I do that? Because if
I
can,
like mini games and stuff, yeah, that you can just.
I'm surprised you're the first person I've heard. Everyone else loves that thing. So, I mean, it's like impossible to find.
Yeah, I was really, really hyped that I managed to get one. Somebody texted me and was like, girl, get on Nintendo right now. And then about 3 other people texted me, including John. I was very thankful for that.
Nice.
So I did manage to get one.
You can sell it for a profit if you want to. You're not into it.
No, it's oh yeah, so the second point of problem that I've run into is this might be a shock to a lot of people, but if you're not naturally inclined to exercise, spending money on a tool that helps you exercise doesn't actually make you exercise more.
Oh, really?
I had no idea. I thought if I spent the money, I would immediately get really ripped, but here we are.
You mean the game doesn't do it for you? You mean you have
I spent
more than get up and, yeah.
I spent this money. I expect to have a high, tight booty, and I don't yet. Like, I don't understand.
All right. Why don't we, I was trying to segue from high tight booty into this, mini Astro Mini, but, I couldn't figure out a way. Except for speaking of high tight booty, which is my catch all segue, let's get into news.
Ta-da.
Gabe, news, theme song, go.
News.
That's like almost like a JJ impression.
Was it really
level? Yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think in this case, genuine JJ is a good thing, but I think
knockoff.
But counterfeit JJ is.
Exactly.
Well, no, it's an art thing. As an artist, you need to learn through imitation and adopting other people's
okay,
techniques.
Okay, that's a good point. All right.
And eventually you find your own voice.
Yep. You get a pass for the next couple ones. No. But okay. you get a pass for the next couple, and then I expect you to have your own original take on
full
the
orchestra.
Theme song. So yes, Sega Astro City Mini has been announced for Japan. That name is probably kind of puzzling for some people, especially people who've never been to a Japanese arcade or seen one of these cabinets. I know, you know, few specialty places have them in the West, but they're ubiquitous. Basically, when you go to an arcade since like the mid 90s in Japan, there's this very iconic shaped stand-up machine, kind of general shape, but you sit down to play it, kind of unique to Japan's style arcade cabinet. And probably the best known example of it is the Astro City, which they all just say Astro Mini on them, despite whatever game is inside of it. So yeah, about $120 this December will get you one of these from Sega Toys. They've announced that it's going to come with 36 games. They've announced 10 of them. Virtua Fighter, Fantasy Zone, Golden Axe, Golden Axe, Revenge of Death Adder, Alien Storm, Alien Syndrome, Columns 2, Dark Edge. That's two different games, by the way. Columns 2 was not subtitled.
Columns 2, Dark Edge.
It should have been like Columns 2, Dark Apocalypse. It's not... The great story mode to Columns 2. Puzzle and action. I thought this said Taint R, but it says Taint R and Altered Beast. I know a lot of people are excited about this. It's got an HDMI port on it. It's got a screen. I mean, it is a little mini, very small. Like, I don't know. What
kind of reminded me of the old... When we were kids, well, some of us anyway, remember the mini like Pac-Man machine or like the kind of desktop arcade, which I know there's a lot of those kind of things now, but
those were little LCD like crappy wannabe versions. These are the game running on. Have they said what's inside? If it's like a Raspberry Pi or
I don't know. I don't think they've said. Well, they probably have said, but I haven't seen it myself. But there's talk about whether. I guess people have noticed that the screen was like 16:9, and there's talk about whether you'll be able to. Like a fans made one of these like about a year ago. Like it looked very similar to this, and you could actually like take the screen off and turn it vertical for like tate mode for like, you know, games where the screen goes
like a right
tall instead of wide
shooter.
Yeah,
where,
And Sega has said that there's, you know, news yet to be revealed regarding the screen, so I kind of wonder if it's something like that. That would be pretty awesome.
But so far, all of these games are Sega games, right? So has Sega themselves published any games that use that ratio?
Or, oh, they must have.
Maybe they could be third-party games, too. Maybe they don't have to all be Sega games, but...
If you haven't seen them, by the way, actually, you know, a perfect example of this is there's arcade cabinets that you can get in Animal Crossing, and they look exactly like this. They have like Astro City themed, the arcade games in Animal Crossing is basically what this looked like.
It's just, so I personally, this seems not a like Game Gear mini level, catastrophe. Games like Virtua Fighter on it, Golden Axe 2, that's pretty cool.
Alien Syndrome, man.
Alien
time
Syndrome.
Bomb is set.
There you go. The time bomb is set. but I do struggle to, like, playing this on a little screen like that. Like, the buttons and everything are going to be authentic, and that seems good. But
yeah, the stick has the, like, screw-off, like, clicky thing or whatever, like the arcade.
And it has an HDMI out, but my thing is, like, unless the screen is some magical, like, recreates the arcade thing, you're going to be better playing this on your TV anyway. And $120 for, you know, 36 pretty old arcade games. Well, yeah,
so
I don't know.
Is the mini cabinet itself fully functional as a cabinet if you wanted to? Like, it has a functional screen?
Yes.
And
exactly.
Yeah,
you can play it on its own. USB
weren't
powered,
like,
I think.
The size of the Indiana Jones idol? Like, weren't these really small?
They're not quite that small. I mean, I'm guessing what a foot and a half tall. About?
Okay, so like you I'm would actually like be able to have your fingers on all the buttons.
Two buttons.
Yeah, so the buttons themselves are actually oversized too, like because of that reason. Okay. If the buttons were like true to spec, it would be too small.
Yeah, mm-hmm. True to scale. It scaled
true
down.
To scale, yeah.
Okay, so they have designed it to be playable as just a cabinet.
Of course, yeah.
I see.
And in fact, there's a separate controller you can buy that sort of mimics the layout of the buttons and stick, but that you can use as just a controller if you really just want to play on your TV.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
The thing is, like, this
for that controller, by the way.
Right, right. And this thing was huge in Japan. I mean, arcades in general and these types of things were big in Japan. So I think it makes sense for Japan as much as any of the other minis did in terms of, like, collectors are going to eat them up. But, like, it really depends on the library, and we only have 10 games right now.
True.
So who's name, you know?
True. Fair enough. We'll watch that. Only announced for Japan right now. I'm curious if they would do like a Western version of this and kind of reshape the cabinet and include those games. Seems like it would still be worth it to do, but who knows? Let's see. Next gen games might finally get a price hike. So it's been two generations, I guess, since the 360, since games kind of moved up from $50 to $60. And now nobody knows for sure yet, but the big one making headlines is NBA 2K21 is confirmed to be the next gen version of it is going to be sold for $69.99, which is $10 more than the Windows, you know, Xbox One, PS4, Switch, Stadia version of it. So just the next gen version, and there's not an upgrade path on that, seemingly, like some of the other, like EA said they were announcing in Microsoft's smart delivery system. So it's been a while. So that was 2005. Thoughts about this?
That sounds high to me. I don't know. I mean, but then again, we live in Japan where like Final Fantasy VII is like literally $100. Yeah, so
a CD is $45.
Right. Yeah.
Like, but it seems like, I mean, to me, a comfortable level was always under $50. Like, of course, under 40 was even better. When it got to 50, it was like, okay, that's fine. But some games were 60, and that's when I start to think about it a little more, you know, do I really want this? Like, you start to dig in a little, and like 70 is the point where it's like, okay, this game, I got to know I really want this game before I'm going to spend that much on it.
Right. Well, yeah, 50 to 60 to me, I remember, seemed like a big mental thing at the time, just because there was the $50 thing. And
sure.
But, you quickly get used to it. And I think taken on its own, same thing. Like $69.99, seeing that just seems like, whoa. But like that said, the fact that games prices, you know, I was buying NES games for $50 and 16-bit games for more than that a lot of times, right? When you had RAM prices, Phantasy Star 2, I think, was like $89.99 or something crazy.
I remember that.
And then in Japan, they were like over, you know, 10,000 yen. Like Super Nintendo games were like, they were basically like $130.
Yeah.
Here in Japan, and the exchange rate was different then too. So like when you take into account the price of other forms of media, like movie tickets and movie rentals and other things that have been kind of creeping up, like it doesn't seem weird to me for that price to move after 15 years. And also, honestly, just as somebody who publishes games, like a lot of times it feels to me like, of course it feels this way after you work on something for like a couple of years, but it's like, God, it's so cheap. And also they're on discount all the time. Now there's such a different multitude of ways to buy games now and ways to not buy games at full price that the full price moving seems like not as big of a deal to me as it once did.
Part of it too. And this is, I mean, I'm fully admitting right now that I'm mostly full of shit. Like part of it is the example you gave too. Is like, I don't know, for some reason, like when I think of like the fact that Final Fantasy VII Remake cost like $60, I think it's $50 now, but like when it came out, it was like $60. And I look at like what went into making that versus like, you know, games like, I don't know, Madden or whatever like that. Like it just seems different to me. So now I'm just letting my own personal bias in, but like I guess depending on the game, the higher price seems justified to me sometimes. But like a game like that, NBA something or other?
NBA
like, why is that $10 more on next gen than on, say, like PS4? Is it that different? It's not that different. It's not going to be that different on PS5. Like, to warrant...
I think it's probably just a publisher... I'm guessing completely that it's a publisher, like...
mandate.
That they're just saying, okay, next-gen games in general are going to cost more to make, as games just sure. do. So we're just going to start charging more. And, like, we haven't raised prices in 15 years. Meanwhile, inflation's done this and something else has done that.
And for the specific example you just gave of, you know, like, well, this sports game is going to be exactly the same game, but it's going to cost more for the newer gen machine. That's also, I think, part of that is preventative measures to not piss off the people who are buying the PS4 version. Because if someone is buying, you know, the PS4 one at the same price as the PS5 one, they're going to be like, well, this value of what I'm getting, is this the same as the newer one, or is the newer one worth all of this, like, expensive?
If the game actually delivers, like, some kind of, you know, obvious improvement that we see, yeah, but yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I agree. But I wonder if that's... I don't see that really happening. I don't think the jump from PS4 to PS5 is going to be so big. But all that said, Mark's probably right. Like, after all this time, I mean... And like I said, Japan costs way more, and I'm not complaining about
Japan.
So I'm just, I think I'm just,
there's
also, you know, I grew up in the US and from the, you know, pretty much almost the beginning of video games too. So like in my head, it's a little bit harder to justify or like mentally imagine like this $70-$80 point for games, but it's probably not that crazy. I mean,
yeah. And I mean, we should say we don't know for sure that this is like going to be the everybody's standard. Yeah, the standard or not, but to be honest,
I doubt first party will get that high.
Yeah, could perhaps not, but to be honest, I feel like in a sense this is probably a super unpopular opinion, but like it's kind of like, well, it's about time almost. Like, really, like price got to move at some point. Like 15 years is a pretty good clip to go without.
It's kind of weird for me to hear when you were reading the article saying, you know, this is what prices used to be and this is what they are now. Because I'm from Canada and I worked at EB Games when I was still there. And I remember at that time, Wii games were $49.99 and PS3 games were usually $59.99. And then something really fancy and like a big deal was $69.99. And when things hit $69.99, we would be like, oh, damn, that's...
Yeah.
Oh boy,
that was
but
yeah.
Those numbers seem like they're the same as what you just said, and then I remembered on the back of every book ever, it's like this book costs $4 in America and $17 in Canada.
Yeah,
so, like, what the fuck do I know?
What was the deal, John? With Nintendo prices were lower on in general on the first party games, right? Were generally cheaper. Was that?
Yeah,
3DS or all systems?
I think it's all systems. And Sony's like that too. Sony first party games are usually $10 cheaper than third party games.
Yeah.
Like God of War and Spider-Man and all those games will typically, unless it's changed.
I thought they finally started making them. I could have sworn like God of War and Spider-Man were full ass price games, but maybe not.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, it's like $30 now, so it's hard to see. It's hard to say at this point. But
anyway, all right. Well, yeah. Watch that with interest.
Don't worry. Whatever the prices are, they're never going to be as bad as Japan.
That's
so
what I'm wondering, though. I wonder if Japan will step up as well. Do you know what I mean? If they will, or if they'll keep them higher as they are now, which would basically be roughly equivalent to what the new prices end up to be in America.
Right. The thing is, with Japan, it's a little bit more obvious to me, I think, or to a lot of people, that they charge what they think they can get as opposed to what they actually, like, necessarily spent or feel like they have to make back. You know, it's like Japan has this attitude about, like, if you deserve to own this game, you deserve to pay a lot of money for this game, regardless of what it costs us to make it.
You get weird prices here sometimes, too, right? Like, it's not like, oh, it's everything is $49.99 or $59.99. You get, like, 7,548 yen, or you know, you get all these weird fucking middle prices for games.
Indeed.
All right. Anyway, moving on. Tales of Arise, John. your hotly anticipated Tales of Arise. next game in the Tales series, delayed beyond 2020. No new release.
They had to take 6 months to fix the name so it actually makes sense.
PlayStation 4, Windows PC, and Xbox One. I think that
the game looks pretty good. That was announced. First Tales in a while. Xbox, that looks exciting. Right?
That was announced at the Xbox
conference. It was. Well, I don't know if it was. No, that was a different game. That was
another different Tales game?
No, it was like that Bandai Namco like Tales looking thing that wasn't a Tales game. Although it could have been at a different Xbox thing, but it wasn't at the recent one.
Oh no, not the recent
last,
one.
Maybe like last year. Yeah, you're probably right. It looks good.
Yeah.
So it looks good, but I don't like it bothers me. Say that again.
Sorry, I was going to ask, which consoles did you say that this was supposed to be for?
PS4, Xbox One, PC.
Mm. It just bugs me when a game from Japan has an English name that literally is breaking like grammatical rules and like the Western branch doesn't stop them. Like it infuriates me. Like that's your job. But anyway.
my thing that I wonder about is, wasn't there a rule that was put where every game that comes out after a certain point has to carry over to the PS5 and the PS4? Like if they're putting
something we out. Talked about that last. Yeah, yeah.
Correct. So it has to be playable on a PlayStation 5 was the thing that was announced. And presumably actually
backwards compatible.
Yeah, with Xbox it's not even I don't think it's even possible to not be forward compatible with Xbox One titles. So you don't have to even check it or whatever. Mm. So yeah, so de facto, that game will be playable on PS5 and Series X. So let's see, that was delayed due to COVID, and also delayed due to COVID. We talked about this a little bit in past podcasts, wondering about it, but Super Mario World, the theme park,
Super Nintendo World.
I'm sorry, what did I say? Super Mario World?
Yeah.
The Super Nintendo World from the Universal Studios Japan section that was going to open June 8th originally, then I think got delayed in late July. And now they've just said it. It's just going to be delayed further.
Indefinitely now, I think. Yeah.
And there have been some recent spy photo video footage of it. It looks pretty cool.
It looks awesome. It looks
really cool.
And there's some stuff that we've talked about on past episodes, but there's been some press conference stuff you can find on it if you want to Dorito it. But there's kind of speculating that the reason why is, basically that even though the theme parks are open here, I think Disney World Tokyo is opening opened again recently.
Did you see the tweet that they sent that or the news that's going around about people going on roller coasters in Disney Tokyo Disney?
Yeah, you can't scream.
Yeah,
that was Fuji-Q.
Scream with your heart.
It was a commercial for Fuji-Q.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
Which is another theme park amusement park here in
yes, scream in your Japan. Heart but not out loud because you're releasing lots of particles.
No droplets.
You can do that. So but yeah, so they're open, but they're following lots of best practices and distancing rules and stuff like that. And this Nintendo thing, when it opens, is going to be swamped, they're sure. So that's
something that I don't really understand about that is delaying it because it's not ready or whatever. Great. But if you're already letting people into the park anyway, seems unwise to delay this anymore. And if the concern, I'm sure you're right that the concern is that people will swamp the park because everyone wants to go to this, but why are they not taking, the Ghibli Museum approach where you get a ticket for a timed entrance on a specific day. And if you don't show up on that day at that time, they won't let you in. And there's only a certain number of tickets issued a day because that would be a better way to control how much traffic is really in the park.
Yeah.
And, they've limited entrance to people who are local to Kansai right now anyway. So,
which is weird. How are they enforcing that? How are they? You have to, show them a piece of mail with your name on it.
You need to be appropriately rude.
They look at your clothes, see if you look like you're from, Ibaraki or something. Just get out.
Should say that you're from Kansai. So you say that. You have permission to say that.
Yeah, I'm not being a hater. Don't worry.
Yeah, you're just talking Kansai Ben and then they let you in. Right. Nintendo's a historically conservative company, so like there's part of it has gotta be that. They just don't want to take any chances with getting people sick, which is, yeah, you know, good. And then also like, well, this may be a smaller thing, but if I were like running this park, I would want the opening to be this like gala, like just right, explosive, awesome thing. And like, you can't do that if you're letting people in like one at a time,
but
trickling in.
Who knows how long it's going to be until that's even an option.
That's true.
Mario is forever, Tina.
Also, given what happened with the Nintendo store here in Tokyo, and that was just a store and how fucking completely swamped it got, I wonder if it's just they thought that limiting it there would be so much of a blowback that it would be so impossible. You know, the amount of people that would want to get tickets, I think, is just going to be freaking crazy. But
dude, that was November. That was eight months ago. And it feels like it was a decade ago. Like, I remember that launch day and it literally was like another world at this point. Yeah. It's crazy.
But you're right. That, like, what does it mean? Does that mean until there's a vaccine that's widely adopted, it just stays closed or what? So we'll see. Let's see. Open world Harry Potter game. Gabe, are you a Harry Potter fan or are you just putting this
in
here?
Do I give that impression?
I don't know. I mean, you put Harry Potter news in the news, it seems like.
No, I read. So Harry Potter is the franchise that ran away from me because.
What's Dumbledore's middle name, Gabe?
Gandalf.
Correct. Correct. Not too many people know that. Okay. You passed the test.
Rock on. Harry Potter for life. Hufflepuff for life.
There you go. Yeah. Do you know what house you are?
Hufflepuff.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay.
You're just saying that because it's the trendy thing to say because nobody liked Hufflepuff until like 2 years ago.
I'm
calling it.
Tina sounds like a fan.
Like, all I have is anecdotal evidence to counter that. So like, I can't.
Well, all I know is that Hufflepuff is a word and it's related to Harry Potter. And that's like within like the five or six words about Harry Potter.
Are there actually no Harry Potter fans in this podcast except for me?
I've read all the books. I wouldn't say I've never played a game or I don't know where my fandom. I've not seen all the movies. But
I mean, read the books. They're not crucial.
Roy looked like he's about to jump out of his gamer chair. There.
I was just gonna say I've seen all the movies. I don't know why, but some friends of mine back in America, we had this thing where like we would see every movie on opening day. Like I don't even know why. I never even read a book. I wasn't like a huge Harry Potter fan. We just it was a thing.
It's a fun thing. Like, brought you together.
Yeah.
You're like, what happened? Wait, why did we do that? You came out. You walked out of the last movie. Like, wow, that was. Wait, why have we been going to every movie on opening day? I just now realized.
I'm 70 years old.
Roy, maybe you can. Yeah. What did I do with my life? Roy, maybe you can buy the open world Harry Potter game on day one when it comes out on track for next year, 2021, according to a Bloomberg report. And I guess early footage of the game leaked. So get hype. You hype, Roy? Tina, will you play this?
I don't like MMOs, so I'll probably not.
I don't think it's an. Is it an MMO? I don't think it's an MMO. I think it's an open world game. No, I think it's a. Role play as a wizard, but I don't know that it's like an online thing.
Oh, I misunderstood. I don't know. I've never played any of the games. I grew up with the books, and they have a very special place in my heart. But you know. The author makes it very hard to want to support her or anything.
Yeah, you're following all that.
I own the books. I have the copies I've had since I was a little kid, and she doesn't deserve any more of my money.
What house are you?
I'm a Ravenclaw.
Okay.
Most definitely.
Okay. Let's see. This is.
You don't know what that means.
I was thinking, like, I have no idea. Someone could ask me that question. Like, I have a house of pain. I have no idea.
But you don't know what houses are in Harry Potter? You
know? No, I know what they are, but I don't know how, like, what, when you ask someone what houses they are, is that just like what your favorite team is or something? Or is there like some formula? Like, your birthday times your like favorite animal is your like Harry Potter name, or something?
Gryffindor, you're like a hero main character. Slytherin, you're like a bad person. Hufflepuff.
That I knew. I knew about Slytherin, yeah.
Hufflepuff, you're like a forgettable like side character. And then,
Until you die.
How, okay, there you go. Spoilers. And how would you sum up Ravenclaw as kind of like an X Factor kind of?
Well, so going in line with the way you just described all the other houses, Ravenclaw are the cool sidekick who help when like they come in clutch at the last minute.
Gotcha. Okay, fair enough. So
all that said, don't support that woman.
Yeah.
Moving on.
let's see. DVRs running on unmodified PlayStation 2s. In news I wish I would have had 20 years ago.
Yeah.
When we used to, and the reason why is not to run pirated software, but working even at video game magazines at that time, we had a hell of a time having enough hardware to play the games that we needed for review. This is a total non-issue now. It seems almost like comical to talk about, but yeah, there was a time when first parties did not provide or provide many units of hardware that were able to play like non-official released retail games. So you couldn't play preview and review games early. And we had to like find a guy you'd buy weed from, like, hey, I know a guy. Okay. Like hook me up. Okay. Bring in the stuff. Okay. You got the stuff. Yeah. We used to have to do that for like our GameCubes and PlayStation 2s, even for one of, you know, the biggest video game magazine in North America at the time. And now turns out that actually there's a way to do it purely through software, through encoding.
It's like the swap trick only for PS2 and like 20 years late. I made a good freelance life off of that because I was living in Japan even back then during the PS2 era, and I was doing stuff for EGM freelance, and I got tons of PS2 stuff because I had a test PS2.
Right.
Because I had a friend in Japan who worked at a game dev. In Japan, they were not hard to buy if you were a developer. And it was like $1,000. And I was like, okay, but I could make this back with freelance money with like a few reviews. So I literally just like a couple months after PS2 came out, I was like, here's $1,000, get me one. He got me one. And then like the reviews came flooding in, and it was because of that. Because like people who could actually play those games were like few and far between.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's kind of interesting. I won't go into too much detail because I don't know what the hell it's talking about. But the exploit was found through the PS2's DVD player. Is kind of the interesting angle on it. So they go into detail about how it kind of tricks the game into it tricks the system into reading different parts of the disc, and things were poorly written, and they take advantage of that, and blah blah blah.
But, which is fascinating, given the actual like test hardware didn't play DVDs. So like, yeah.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah,
that is interesting. Let's see. Nintendo president apologized for Joy-Con drift. So this is a big story, but also kind of a non-story, where it was brought up in one of those shareholder meetings.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah,
and Nintendo president Furukawa basically just started his answer saying, you know, he was asked about it regarding the Joy-Con. We apologize for any trouble caused to our customers. This is a Kotaku translation. And then they just goes, you know, we're aiming to improve our products. And then he talks about the class action lawsuit happening in the U.S. So saying he's not going to really talk much about it.
It finally struck me.
Yeah.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. It's happened. And I have a spare set of Joy-Cons, so it's not the end of the world. And most of the time when I'm playing on my TV with the Pro Controller, so it's really not devastating for me, but it's fucking weird when you're like...
It's annoying.
You're trying to dig a hole in a certain place, and your character's like, nope, LOL, and just goes off someplace else. It's really disorienting.
If you have old Joy-Cons that are, well, not old, but if you have Joy-Cons that have that problem, one thing you could do is just make them be your like default Ring Fit Joy-Cons that use for that, because you don't need the drift part very much at all, the stick part.
Well, and you can, is your Switch, Tina, American or Japanese?
Japanese.
Okay. So, I mean, I think you can send it in here as well too, right? And get it fixed for free. I know
are they doing it? In America.
They were, but like, oh, I don't know if they're doing it right now.
I thought they had stopped all of it, but I also haven't really looked into it. I just kind of was like, oh, gee, that sucks. And then.
Right.
Sure. I actually had a Switch problem just turn up this week, actually. My Animal Crossing Switch, which is not even that old, right? I got it when Animal Crossing came out. The right Joy-Con, the X button, like, doesn't take every time now. Like,
what?
I noticed, like, yeah. And like, I mean, yes, I've played like 400 hours of Switch since I bought this thing, because I know from Animal Crossing and Dragon Quest X, but like even so, like,
yeah, that's
Animal Crossing, you use the X button a lot. And yeah, like I started noticing this week that like a lot of times it doesn't take on the first press. So like I'm going to have to, I guess, get new Joy-Cons again or something, or just play on TV.
That is not cool. It seems like almost it's not cool every at all. System these days, almost everyone, you know, PlayStation 4 had that thing, especially on the early
yes, systems. Where like the sticks got weird.
The sticks getting weird, and the triggers as well. My triggers ended up messing up after playing a bunch of Destiny. Like, seems like a more recent problem. But
raise your hand if you still got controllers that are like 30 years old and still work just fine.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, my old stuff is all great. like I mean my I, we talk thing. About this every now and then, but like you turn an old handheld too and like the batteries are still working from like 15 years ago. Yeah. But like,
and they still feel great. The buttons still spring back just right. Like,
yeah, everything was better back in our day. That's basically I think what I'm going after. Let's see. Final Fantasy 14 patch. We talked about that. Delayed to August 11th. Are you guys still playing regularly, John?
I am.
I think Gabe is playing like every day, right?
I am in a deep, deep, deep crafting hole right now.
Do we need an intervention, Gabe?
They streamline crafting enough that you can take it from level 1 to level 80 in a reasonable, if you're doing one crafting class at a time. But that game's crafting system is so interconnected. You just do all 8 if you're going to do one. So I'm.
When you say reasonable amount of time, though, what does that mean to you? Because what it means to you and what it means to, like, say, Mark is probably very zero? Different things.
If you, yeah, if you
I stopped listening after I heard crafting.
it's. I would say, like, the prep is one thing, but if you were to just do it, or if you have the money to shortcut stuff, you could get one crafting class to 80 and maybe. A weekend at most to
a weekend.
Saturday.
I thought he was going to say like a month or something.
We're 3 weeks into from nothing to all of them, and like no, just I'm
the,
starting.
The fact that you said a weekend, not a couple of hours or whatever, threw me the fuck off because it was like
I'm typing
in hours, and you're like, you know, 2 days.
Yeah, that's how MMOs work. It's like, oh yeah, it's a weekend. All right, cool.
Hey Roy, are you ever gonna get back into 14?
You should.
That's another game like Monster Hunter that I'm like, well, I have a whole lot of time on my hands, and I spend a whole lot of it in front of a screen. So something like that would be good. It's just, yeah, 14 is tough because it's a lot more to pick up. I think like Monster Hunter is just like second nature to me now, but it's been a long time.
Sure, you can just jump in and go.
Yeah.
I would say the patch that's coming out is the one to jump in on, because that's the streamlining of the 1 to 50. It's adding flying to 1 to 50 areas.
I'm excited for that patch. We're not playing right this minute, mostly because I've been playing a lot of Dragon Quest X, but I am definitely planning to get back. Like, I'm right in the middle of the third expansion, and I loved it. So,
are they still updating Dragon Quest X, like, regularly?
Dragon Quest X is being updated regularly. Yeah, they're up to 5.2 now. And I'm story wise at like 2.1, so I have a long ass way to go to catch up, but I'm enjoying it.
Wow. Okay.
Later
this summer, let's see, will this be in time for our next podcast? Actually, we might just miss some of these, right? So, two Xbox things announced: Xbox Summer Game Fest demo event, July 21st. 75 to 100 unreleased games. You can just go in on your Xbox One dashboard. Something's going to appear and go in, and just a shit ton of demos are going to be there.
Whoa, that's awesome.
It's really cool, right? And normally these days, demos are for games that have already come out, but these are early looks.
Are they going to go away or something after the few days? Or is that how, or like,
I'm assuming this is only available for the week that they've said, but.
Yeah, the story. Or the news was saying that it's for things that are really, really early in development that like normally wouldn't have a demo, but because they can't do an E3 type E3 event, they don't that have any early looks. They're letting people try out
games that would have been at E3. Yeah, that makes total sense.
So I can't imagine they would let people keep those for a significant amount of time.
That'd be awesome.
And then also they announced a showcase. Sounds like of sorts for that same week. What is it, 23rd? I think.
Or was that the big one that they were talking about last time, or was that just?
I think so. Yeah, people are talking about Halo a lot. Because of that, so I'm assuming that's the one they were saying, like it was going to show like the full guns ablazing, whereas last time it was more like a third party and in indie stuff. That this one,
I feel like I saw like some rumors of like people saw like Twitter accounts made for some. Was it Perfect Dark or something? Or
oh,
like
really?
Or Camp?
I missed this.
Fable and Perfect Dark, right?
Fable and Perfect Dark. Yeah, like somebody tracked Twitter accounts back to Microsoft. So you know, I mean, neither of those games really excite me, but I am at least glad to. I would be glad to see some of the older like kind of exclusive franchises. You know, something besides Halo and Gears, basically. You know, coming
there
out
was
of Microsoft.
A rumor
so.
That somebody else might be doing Perfect Dark, and it wasn't Rare. Which seems weird, but yeah. And I mean, Rare
is probably busy with Grab by the Ghoulies too.
Yeah, I won't do my instinct is to immediately do that Shane Grab by the Ghoulies voice, and I have to stop myself from doing that. They did show that game briefly, that Monster Hunter kind of looking thing last fall. XO, that was a Rare thing that I'd even forgotten about. I don't know if you guys remember.
I already forgot about it.
Yeah,
so no.
Kind of cartoony, looked very Monster Hunter-esque. They only had like a teaser thing. I'm wondering if that will be part of what they show. But Rare's kind of due. It's been a while since Sea of Thieves, so I would hope that we see at least something from Rare. They have that new studio, The Initiative, I think it's called, in Santa Monica. Some people are wondering. I think somebody reported, Jeff Grubb, I think, reported that they're not going to be showing their game because that studio is relatively young still. But yeah, all the studios that Microsoft has acquired, Ninja Theory, of course, a bunch of the other ones might have stuff. So yeah, it'll be exciting to see. I mean, I feel like this is Microsoft's chance to really answer that that PlayStation 5 conference. So it will be really interesting
to see
what they do with it. Maybe is it, you know, too early to get a date and price? Would they have announced that at E3? You know, recently people hold that info pretty close to the vest until the last minute. So maybe not. But yeah, I'm
what do you think? When do you guys think it's coming? Predictions, Xbox release date. Silence.
Don't everybody shout out at once.
I think it's, I'm going to say October. I'm going to say they're going to come early.
I'm going to say...
What have they said so far? Let me look.
Nothing, I think. Just this year, right?
Just holiday. I'm going to say...
Holiday?
Because there's that rumored Xbox Series S that is not the X that's going to have the price difference. So I'm going to say...
I saw that. And possibly like less powerful or something? Or
it seems like not necessarily in terms of performance, but like just less graphical fidelity.
Right, like you don't need 4K, you don't need
HDR,
whatever.
So I'm going to say the main tower thing, that'll probably be like October, and then the little brother, little sister is going to be the S, I would say like December.
Wait, you're thinking they would release those two?
Why not together?
Separately?
Yeah. This is just assuming like pandemic production lines. We got to get one or two out the door. Let's just stagger it so we can get our name out there.
You've constructed
Bill Gates is hand modeling each one by hand as we speak.
This is roughly, and I did the math, 8,000% speculation on my part.
Yeah, you've constructed a whole little like fan fiction around.
I got an algorithm here.
Being made at Microsoft factories in China and everything. I think that the fact that they're saying holiday says to me no sooner than November. Like,
sure.
October just doesn't mean holiday to me. Like, but
no, it doesn't. You're right. I guess having watched like Microsoft's steps so far, you know, from like the first talking of this to now, and how they contrary they have been to like historical, like what you would think a company would do, I just am kind of expecting more surprises or weirdness out of them, you know.
First mover, yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if anything, I think that would hold them back from doing that, I think it would be just game production.
Sure.
But that said, Halo has come out. Like it's like a Call of Duty where it comes out pretty early in the fall a lot of times. So, you know, that would make sense. The whole holiday thing could be like a head faint to throw Sony off. But with COVID this year, I think a lot of games are going to come out pretty rough and need patches. And and whatever. So I think maybe they have to come out by Black Friday, no matter what. I think
for sure.
But there is some weight, I think, to the console coming out relatively early for holiday, because software can always come later. You know, if they wait to put it out until late November, and then there's a scramble and not everyone who wants one can get one, and then it fucks up a bunch of people's Christmas / whatever. But I don't know. Yeah. That's entirely just like it could just be that they want to get the machines out the door as fast as possible so that then more people can buy more games for gifts in the holiday season.
Sure.
Maybe Microsoft and Sony are secretly talking to each other and like planning the date, so they're both on the same day and there's not going to be any, you know.
I do think in a year when I have no data to back this up, but I would be really interested that, you know, if you have a game like Cyberpunk, when does Cyberpunk come out?
I think it's November now, right?
Yeah, it got delayed again, right?
Cyberpunk.
We talked about it last time, so.
Without knowing that date, I think there is a big thing to be said for like, okay, a lot of people are going to fucking play that game. What the hell? Google is still saying September 17th, which is wrong. Oh, November 18th. I think, yeah, like a lot of people are going to play that game. People are going to want to play it on a next-gen system. If hypothetically one of the systems was out by then and one of them isn't, I do think that could, something like that could move the needle, you know? So,
true.
Maybe it'll come out on Cyberpunk Day or by then, seems like now.
Right.
God, I'm so excited for that game. I don't know if you guys give a shit about that game at all, but I'm
Cyberpunk?
Yeah.
I didn't know you were like super into it.
All I've seen about it was the collective, just like Twitter shitting on the hotel sign. The like hotel sign.
Ah, yeah, the mix of Romaji and katakana.
Yeah. If you can't read it, I fully get why that would look cool as fuck. But as soon as you can read it, you're just like, why?
It's the dark future, Tina. This is what happens. It's gone amok.
It makes sense in that world.
It absolutely does. I mean, Cyberpunk is very much like 90s vision of what... Yeah, it's very like...
Blade Runner.
Bad, not even Blade... Like wannabe Blade Runner. Like Johnny Mnemonic. Right. Like bad Keanu Reeves. Like B-movie. I swear he made like five of them. In the early 90s, they were like Cyberpunk related before the Matrix. Yeah, that would have been before the Matrix. But anyway, yeah, I'm all about it. That like there's been more previews and more information about that game, and I finally got to the point where I just shut it off because I just want to play it.
I hope it's good. I didn't like, as much as I wanted to love The Witcher, I couldn't deal with it for more than like 2 hours. Like, it's just...
Yeah, I don't know why I never fully invested enough to really give that game a chance, which makes no sense at all. Except for the main character, I just can't imagine a world or a drug that I could be on and think that he looked cool. Like,
right.
In any sense of the word. It just looks to me like... Yeah, I won't say what it looks to me like, but it's not something I aspire to.
Yeah, I felt the same way, and that's why I'm more excited about Cyberpunk, because it's like make your own character, so I'm down.
I just had a realization though, because I do currently have long hair, and Halloween is coming up, and I was thinking, what is a Halloween character where I could use my long hair? Flash cut to me dressed up as a Witcher guy, yeah, in a hot tub with my hair bleached.
It's not like you're gonna be going anywhere on Halloween anyway, yeah. Though. So, Zoom Halloween,
the all important gram, you know, Instagram, which I'm not on at all. Horizon Zero Dawn coming to PC August 7th. Very bad.
They finally admitted that.
Yeah, via Steam and Epic Game Store. $50. So yeah, that'll be 3 years after it came out on the PlayStation 4 as an exclusive. This is kind of wild. I mean, I think we're not surprised by this news because it was rumored for so long, and Sony's kind of made other baby steps into the PC area. But this is kind of wild. You know, this is a full-blown first-party studio. full exclusive game that is coming out on PC and going to have a whole bunch of improvements. Dynamic foliage, as the French would say, improved reflections, bells and whistles, like unlock frame rates, ultra-wide monitor support, several pages of graphic settings. I think it's doubly weird that it's coming out this close to PlayStation 5 coming out, because you'd think, oh, that's an easy PlayStation 5 update.
But why not when you can make all your money on this PC version and then put it also out on PS5, like as a free update, you know, a year later or whatever?
Maybe,
right?
So, but like, as Sony, is your motivating factor in getting the PS5 install base, you know, getting people to ramp up to your next thing, or is it just, you know, make a buck?
Right, right.
Which I think it's both of those things, but I would just think that the overriding goal there right now would be, okay, we need to transition people over. Like, how are we going to do that?
Right.
But who knows?
You just, yeah. Mark, you just made me think of a conversation I had this week when you mentioned the French pronunciation. Tina, you're not allowed to answer this because you're from Canada, but Mark, how do you say this word? Can you see this? Is this backwards for you?
Yeah. That's tintin.
Right?
Yeah. As in Rin Tin Tin.
Right. Tina, how would you say this?
So I know what you're trying to trap me in.
Wait, do you? It's not a trap.
I also call him Tintin because I saw him on English TV. But okay. if I'm reading it as a French name, it's Tintin.
Right. And like, I was talking about Tintin? This with
Tintin.
Well, it's like Tang or something, or Tantan, I guess, is like actually how you pronounce this. And like my girlfriend was talking to me the other day about this for some reason. She's like, you know, she was describing some character or something, and she's like, you know, like in Tantan. And I'm like, what the fuck is Tantan? It's like, you mean like Tantan Men? You know, like the noodle soup? And she like flipped that back on me. She's like, how the hell do you not, like, she got all excited. Like, how do you not know what Tantan is? And we looked it up, and it turns out Tintin is actually pronounced Tantan is the correct pronunciation. Yeah. So, yeah, you're making the French comment just got me thinking about that. Generally, I figured that's probably like my one chance ever to bring this up to anybody else. So
generally, I tend to default to Japan is probably right when it comes to katakana-ized versions of other languages. Word,
right?
Because they tend to get it right when a lot of the time English will just make it easier for an English speaker to say.
Right But also, like, with this too, if it actually was Tintin and you put that in katakana, the result would not be a word that was it ends up sounding basically like the Japanese word for dick. So
I guess it would, wouldn't it?
But anyway, sorry for the aside.
All kinds of learning here on the A4 Play Podcast. That's just about it for news. We do have the patch notes for the Monster Hunter World, a title update. That's number 4. Maybe
it's out
we'll
right
save
now.
That. Yeah, it just came out. Seeing some Twitter chatter about it, but maybe Roy can give us a full first party report.
Gabe took the day off tomorrow to play it.
Oh,
yeah.
Shit. Yeah. Oh.
Well, I'm taking my day off for my birthday, and I decided the right way to be unproductive was to do Monster Hunter all day. So, Roy, you're invited.
Right.
Just don't tell John.
Are you
Roy
playing
like
on
to
PC?
Play Monster Hunter with his friends.
I have it on PC, yeah.
Okay. I have like 400 hours on PS4, so.
So I have a PS4 copy, but I never opened it because load times.
I bought a SSD for my PS4 Pro just to not have load times in Monster Hunter.
Yeah, like, I thought about it.
But yeah.
This patch is PS4 only, right?
Oh, wait, is it? I thought they finally synced up.
Yeah, I think it's for all consoles.
Oh.
For all whatever. I think it's for everything.
Okay. Well, right, more power to them. They definitely have the detailed patch notes thing down, which I'm super happy to see. Not everybody.
I haven't actually played Monster Hunter since, I want to say, like last year. So
you didn't play Iceborne, or did you play?
No, I bought Iceborne because it was on the Steam sale, barely, but it was still on sale. So I'm actually wondering, like, now I think is the right time to start a new weapon, because I was doing the light bowgun, because controllers, having played Monster Hunter on the 3DS prior to this, I always ignored the range weapons. So now that they.
It's like a different game.
Yeah.
That's interesting, though. Like, I think Monster Hunter Weapon is almost like a Harry Potter house-esque, like, personality test.
So I actually, I've never stuck to one weapon. So like my first Monster Hunter was 3U, the Wii U re-release of Tri, I guess.
Right.
And that one I was Lancer. And then for 4, I was Charge Blade or Charge Axe. That was in Japan.
Yeah. JJ, I think, was Lance. Roy, you kind of played the field, right? You switch it up a lot. Did you have a go-to?
I basically can play anything, but I hate the insect stick. Like, to me, that thing is should be in the game. Get it out of the game.
I love the idea of it. It was awesome. Yeah. I never got super.
Wait, what is an insect stick?
Well, it's actually insect wave. Yeah.
It's an insect stick, which you, it's like a pole, like in American Gladiators, they would hit each other with. But
Q-tip.
Also with a big bug. It was called your kinsect because he was your friend. And it was like a big bug that would go out and like infect the monsters with things or do different powers and stuff. It's kind of cool.
It was a weapon that completely relied on status inducing abilities, is what you're saying.
It was like a game on top of itself because you had to hit depending on what part of the monster you hit with your kinsect, you would get a buff that would then transfer to you onto your weapon. So if you hit the head, you got the orange, I think, for defense.
I know for certain I would not have used that. I've never played Monster Hunter a day in my life. I know for sure I wouldn't.
But if you got all three buffs, then you got a super buff on top of that that unlocked a different, slightly different movesets, and then would make you cooler.
What about now, Tina? Does that convince you?
You're losing me, man. You're increasingly losing me.
All right. Yeah, I think we're losing everybody. So why don't we stop it here and take a quick break? When we come back, we're going to have our special guest, who I should have teased earlier, but it's friend of the show, one Mr. Matt Ault, who's here to talk about his new book, which does involve Japan and games and Japanese games, among other things. So stick around. Most of us will be coming back. We'll lose a couple people. Roy and Tina, you guys want to give your Twitter handles where people can find you so we can lose you without guilt?
Yikes.
I'm at Kodori.
And Tina? I am at Tina Butts with 2 T's and a Z.
Right on. Thanks, guys. Everybody else, stick around, and we'll be back with Matt Ault talking about his book, Pure Invention.
Bye.
And we are back with finally we got him, first time, long time, friend of the show, one Mr. Matt Ault.
A Matt, wild Matt Ault appears.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Not been on this podcast before now? Like,
I know it's weird.
Your agent never returns our calls.
Exactly.
You know, for the last 10 years.
I had my people call your people. I don't know. It's funny though, you know, it's Tokyo is simultaneously this like megalopolis and a small place at the same time. So like, even though our paths are always, we're all here, but like I feel like our paths are more parallel than crossing. If you know
that's
what
true.
I mean.
No, I mean, that's what I was going to say. You live almost a parallel life in many ways, like having your own, I mean, primarily a localization business. You do a lot of other stuff there. Alt Japan.
Yes.
You do a lot of gaming stuff, and I think did do more of that. You're branching out into a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Now, manga, TV stuff. You do like on-air personality stuff. You have the books.
Writing. Authoring. All Japan started as a low company, but it was really like a vehicle for us to do what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, when we started doing this, like nobody – It was basically me and like Alex Smith and like, you know, a handful of other people out there, you know, Jeremy Blaustein, you know, Richard Honeywood. This is like the League of Extraordinary Gaijin.
This is all, is all people who have been on this podcast. Why it seems only appropriate for you well, now to be on it, but
you have the best.
Finally got the Red Ranger.
Exactly. You know, right. you tried the best. Now try the rest. Something like that.
But it's good timing because you got your book out, yes. Pure Invention, How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World. Do you want to, I'm sure you have the elevator pitch down to,
well, here, I should just read the inside jacket 15. Flap. No, it's about, Pure Invention is a book I've been working on for the last 2 or 3 years. And it is about how Japanese products basically took over global fantasies and rewired reality in the process. And it tells that story through a series of hit inventions that everybody knows, like the karaoke machine. And I have to I always say karaoke when I'm doing this in English instead of the karaoke machine. You know, like the Walkman, Hello Kitty products, anime as a medium, you know, schoolgirl culture.
Mm-hmm. And game
channel, board video channel. Games.
Right.
Video game. Oh, that's right. Video games.
Why
that's
you're right. here, Matt.
That's right. There was a small section on video games. I believe they did change the world. Yeah, and it's about that, and it's about how those products hit not just because they were cool, but because we were all starting to come and share a Japanese worldview, Japanese sensibilities ourselves, because our society was coming to resemble theirs.
Right.
And that's the story. That's the elevator pitch. So yeah, see you guys later. Thanks. Bye.
So we're going to focus a lot on the on the gaming bits here, but
that makes sense.
But I want to say, like, you know, me and I think John, you had the same experience, but I was trying to like skim through and just find the video game parts, but kept finding myself starting to read about stuff like the Walkman or Hello Kitty or stuff. It's all super, super interesting, fascinating stuff. So I'm like really excited to go back and actually just like read
it
cover to cover. Really cool. But the gaming stuff is really great too. A lot of fleshed out stories I had heard about before, but also some new bits and anecdotes. And I think the kind of I think you have a lot of things that I've thought about before, but like framed in an interesting way. I think like you're
like
kind of
what?
Well, like you're like, well, I'm glad you asked, Matt. Why am I here telling you? I think you had an interesting kind of, maybe it was in your prologue. I don't know if it's like the thesis statement of your book or if it's that all encompassing, but you know, how you talk about that in the 80s and leading up to the 80s, Japan had really come to economic prominence, really right. selling the world things right. that the world needed. And that as the economy collapsed,
right.
and as it, or, you know, just went into the lost decades where it basically like flatlined, that then shifted into this like the quote unquote kind of like soft power kind of cultural
yeah.
influence and all the different ways that happened. And like, video games is the obvious one to us as people who follow the industry,
sure.
industry and grew up in the 80s. But like, why, you get into this in the book, but maybe you can start talking there
yeah.
broad strokes. Like, why in the 80s was it Japan of all places that gave us, you know,
sure.
Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and then Nintendo and stuff? Like, why, what are the things that led to that kind of happening?
Yeah, it's you know, and you hit it on the head. Like the kind of one of the core thoughts of the book is that, you know, Japan made itself rich by selling the world the things that it needed, like, you know, cars and electronic devices of all kinds, but it made itself loved by selling us inessential things that we didn't need but we consumed nonetheless because they were so alluring to us. And video games are even more than that. They're like a kind of Rosetta Stone for conveying Japanese sensibilities like directly into the hearts and minds of young Americans and Westerners in general. And there was a really interesting moment when I was talking to Masayuki Uemura, who is the engineer who actually made the family computer, the Famicom.
The legend. Yeah.
The legend. Yeah. He's now working for Ritsumeikan University's Game Preservation Center, the Game Research Center, I think it's called.
Yeah.
And he said something like, you know, we just got really lucky because we were able to fall back on all of these conventions from anime and manga that Westerners didn't know. And so it just seemed so fresh and new to you guys. And we really lucked out that way. And it's true because like in the West, basically games came first and then we got into anime. Whereas in Japan, obviously manga and anime came first and the game directors borrowed it from that.
Yeah. It was so interesting to me. Like I remember when Street Fighter 3 came out and the fidelity was finally getting
right
to where you could see more what the artists were seeing in their head. And to me, Street Fighter 2, you know, I just think it's trying to be realistic. But then once you see the fidelity, it's like, no. The creators of these games are actually seeing like the anime characters in it. So you also talk about Mr. Umemura. You have a great, the full interview up on Kotaku, which people...
Yeah, they ran that. Out. That was really nice of them.
Yeah, but some really great, that's a good example of some kind of confirmed things I'd kind of heard, but also like fleshing out anecdotes. So the thing about the color scheme of the Famicom, which is also the 8-4 right. colors, but being based on the then President Yamauchi's scarf, like a favorite scarf that he had.
Right, I love that. Right.
Great story. And then the thing about him getting drunk, which I had not heard this before.
Oh, man.
About him relaying the story about how, I mean, it sounds like it was just a normal thing that Yamauchi would have a couple, call him at night and tell him, I want this, that, and the other thing. And then half the time he just ignored it. But then he calls him the next morning and it's like, no, I really do want that cartridge system.
Right.
Before he's like, oh, shit.
You're working on that, right?
Yeah.
It's like Yamauchi is like, he was such a character. I really wanted to make him more of a character in the book, but he's really, as far as Westerners are considered, kind of more of a behind the scenes sort of character, because we always interacted with like the Nintendo of America people.
Right.
But in Japan, he's like this singular presence, and there's all sorts of like great anecdotes. Like, you know, like he made Gunpei Yokoi, who is, you know, the genius engineer who hired Uemura at Nintendo and who basically turned Nintendo into a toy company himself, famously was being forced to chauffeur Yamauchi around and use that opportunity to kind of pitch him on the idea of making the game and watch. And Yamauchi's like, shut up and drive, just shut up and drive, you know, kind of thing. And Gunpei Yokoi is like, no, sir, really, I think we can make something out of this. And Yamauchi's like, whatever. And like, he thought it was just a lost cause. And then Yamauchi comes back weeks later and says, okay, make this, you know, kind of thing. So it was this weird hierarchy. Like, you're basically kind of like, I think you'd have this kind of, you're interacting with the king, you know what I mean? Or like the emperor kind of thing. And
it was totally that. It was one man's whims could control, you know, what's now this huge global company with all of these different considerations. But like the great Yamauchi stories, a lot of them are like that. Like Hank Rogers, like he like playing Go with them. And so,
Go,
you have the license, just go and do it or whatever. Right. And he'd have, he didn't like play the games himself. He'd have people play the games for him, but still was really good at sussing out what were going to be, you know, the hits. You have the story in there about Donkey Kong and how.
Just well, Hank Rogers really nailed it in the head. He said something like, you know, Yamauchi couldn't play games, but he could really play people.
Ah, interesting.
And, you know, one of the big takeaways I had when I was writing that chapter is that, you know, I didn't realize how late to the game Nintendo was in coming up with games. Like, and until Donkey Kong was invented or developed by, you know, Miyamoto and Yokoi working together, they'd been just seen as this like third rate knockoff company who was just a trend chaser and wasn't really going to amount. Like, who's this card company? Like, what are these guys going to do? Because Taito and like, you know, Namco, like those guys were the titans back then, right?
Nintendo was
this old dude running the company. He's making like Hanafuda cards. Oh, he made that little magic hand thing.
Yeah. Exactly. You know? There was a lot of those. Those kind of things. And you tell the whole like Invader Boom story there, which I always find super fascinating. One aspect of that you actually you brought up in the book and led me to a question that I don't know that any of us are going to know the answer to, but why do you know why arcade games in Japan, even still to this day, are much lower, like squatter to the ground, but early on were almost exclusively what we now call like cocktail cafes, right?
Yeah.
But in the West, we had stand-up cabinets. There were cocktail cabinets, but they were kind of the exception.
This is just my, that's a really good question, and this is just my speculation.
Yeah.
But one thing you got to remember is that when video games first came out, they were seen as competition for pachinko. and Pachinko is played sitting down.
Yeah.
And so, and like, I actually found this really amazing documentary that was filmed on NHK like in 1978 or 79 when Space Invaders came out. And it's literally frames the entire segment as, are Japanese going to leave pachinko for this strange new form of entertainment? It seems that way.
Right.
And it was just all like spun as this, like, it's pachinko, but it's on a TV screen. And I was thinking to myself, wow, I never ever thought of this as being like pachinko, but I guess it is, in the sense, right, like you're sitting down and doing this repetitive activity. Obviously no money or whatever, those little ball bearings you get in pachinko,
right,
are involved. But I think that's where that comes from. It was, and gaming in Japan was like always an adult activity.
Right.
Like, it was a grown-up thing that you did. And like,
coffee shops, basically,
yeah,
right? Early on.
And there's all these pictures of dudes with, like, really bored girlfriends, like, going on dates and, like, you know, these dudes smoking and, like, all, like, there's amazing photographs of, like, the, like, 1979, 1980, around that time frame, when literally an arcade meant a room full of Space Invaders games.
Right.
You know, and they were called... Yeah.
You talk there, too, about the knockoffs that happened and how the, you know, Japanese organized crime, the Yakuza, were behind a lot of the counterfeit games because they didn't, I mean, I guess this was more Breakout.
The breakout clones, yeah.
Yeah, Breakout for sure. Yeah, but, I mean, it makes sense because it's like that, you know, and most famously it happened that Namco had to battle those guys. Namco was really locked in a situation where they were being flooded by clones and not getting very much support from Atari at the time. And so they were really kind of up a creek. And actually, there's a famous moment where Nakamura, the president of Namco, has to go try to negotiate with those guys and decides he's not going to give in to any of their demands and just do it his own way. It's like a really interesting sort of moment from Japanese game history.
I feel like there's vestiges. I had never understood why. And I did, this is not something I knew until I'd been, like, you know, following Japanese games for a long time, but that there was like an association, especially early on, between video games and the Yakuza, and some prominent like Japanese publishers and stuff.
Sure.
Supposedly, I'm not going to name any names because I don't want to like besmirch reputations, but some like still relevant, still known games are kind of widely, not openly, but kind of thought of as like, oh yeah, well there's like Yakuza ties back deep somewhere, or were years ago. And I had to wonder when I read that if that was something that came out of that.
Well, I didn't actually really cover this much in the book for a couple reasons. Number one, because it's limited to Japan. It's not really about the like takeover of the Western mind, but another because it's kind of scary stuff, you know. Right. And it's like are you a gangster? You know, it's like, did your money come from the underworld? It's like you can't really it's tough to ask. But you know, if you just look
to this podcast though, Matt.
So exactly. Boy, what are you talking about? This is the most popular podcast among the Japanese underworld. Anyway, that's what I heard anyway. So if you just look at it like kind of logically, it's a cash based business that's basically real estate based because, you know, the most lucrative arcades are the ones in the best locations. And especially in the 80s, there's a lot of like, you know, organized crime involved in real estate and involved in pachinko industry. And
back to the pachinko thing, right? If this is for pachinko.
Well, you can imagine that suddenly an invader room goes in down the street from pachinko parlor and suddenly their revenues drop by like 75%. Right. Well, suddenly you get this like Al Capone type situation. Like, who are these guys, you know, down the street with their little invaders, you know? And I can imagine very easily something like that happening. But yeah, I mean, you know, gaming was seen as like a really kind of grown up subversive activity. And like PTAs were trying to stop kids from going into arcades. Like it was a really big deal.
Well, and you mentioned they succeeded to an extent, right? They got that law passed.
Yes.
I knew the existence of this law, this kind of, well, I'll let you talk about it, but I had never put together associating that with the rise of home video games here.
Yeah, so it's important to remember there was never a game industry crash in Japan. That was a purely American phenomenon. Games were still selling here. They were mainly kind of like computer systems, though, back then. Like, everybody had a keyboard on their machine and was trying to, like, kind of... Like, remember the ColecoVision Atom?
Oh yeah.
You know, where you you had like a crappy keyboard hooked up to a crappy like printer and a crappy like, and you kind of turned your game system into a sort of crappy PC.
I was fascinated to learn that you mentioned that the LCD business experienced some sort of crash, like the Game & Watch kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what
around the same. I didn't even know that. Like, and you know, that sort of thing is fascinating that happened in Japan at the same time. You should keep going, but
yeah, no. I mean, that was just like the Game & Watch, which obviously spawned a lot of clones. It was the biggest thing from like what 1980 or so for like, but games, like, this is another thing that came up in my conversation with Uwe. Remember, games were considered toys and they last 3 years. That's how long the boom was, and that's done. You have to move on to the next thing. But the thing that Mark was talking about that I found really fascinating too is that unlike a lot of places all around the world tried to pass ordinances like keeping kids away from arcades. But it didn't really succeed in many places, but it did succeed here in Japan. And like, they passed this really restrictive law. And when it took effect, basically, if you were a kid, you had a choice, either play games at home or stop playing video games. And this is the exact same year the Famicom came out. So guess what kids chose to do?
Yeah. So was it under a certain age, basically? Was it?
Yeah, I think it was 20, under 20.
Oh, wow.
Like, if you're... Yeah, I'm pretty.
It's amazing that arcades ever came back. Did that law just lapse eventually, or like, you know?
Well, certainly when I moved here, you didn't see kids in like gakuran and Japanese school uniforms in arcades. They would have to. You couldn't go into an arcade wearing a uniform. And I remember when I did a homestay here in the 80s, there was like a really big deal about the kids making sure to get out of their uniforms before we. You know, they were acting all like, you know, this is like the first time I came to Japan on a homestay was like in 89 or so. So like, this is like peak arcade in America. Wow. It's like Stranger Things, you know, like, hey, let's go to the arcade. And they were like, wait, let's not let anybody see us. You know? And it was like, it felt like sneaking into a dirty movie or something like that.
Right.
You know, these are kids who would like think nothing of like leaping the turnstile at the train station with their student uniforms on,
but paused on playing arcade.
Exactly, which didn't want to be seen playing, you know, Virtual Fighter or whatever it was that was hot at the time. Actually, 89. I don't think Virtual Fighter was around then. That was like 90s, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah, it was 90s. Yeah. But yeah, I'm sure it was Final Fight or something. Maybe, I don't know.
Oh yeah! Wow.
How did you get hooked up there with Uemura-san?
Okay, so this is the thing. This is one of the big things I learned doing this book. Companies will not help you at all whatsoever.
Right.
You have to track down people who are mainly retired, aren't. And like, so for the Walkman chapter, I managed to talk to like really key members of that team. They're all retired. That's why. If you call Sony, then it becomes this whole big deal where they have to set it up. And like, I did call Sony. Totally. Actually, when the book was done, I called Sony because I wanted to just check some facts and stuff like that. And I actually had them read they have like an archive division, and they were actually really cool. Nintendo never ever got back to me, even about questions like, you know, hey, I'm happy to pay. Can I use an image of Mario? You know,
right. Like,
very kind of standoffish that way. But Uemura-san was great. I mean, he's now a professor at a university. He's an academic now. And, you know, I was, these aren't like gotcha questions. Like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Okay. You didn't try this? Yeah. No, it's like, you know, it's like, what was it like? You know, what was your thinking when you were engineering this like epoch making, as the Japanese would say, fantasy delivery device?
Yeah. And that's fascinating that you can get a hold of guys like that, because, you know, Japan is notoriously like tight-lipped, even when like it's sort of the, I don't know if it's an honor thing or what, but a lot of people even in retirement won't actually talk because they don't want to upset the company that they, you know, basically grew up in. But, you know, that leads to a sort of there's not a lot of information out there about a lot of really fascinating things.
Well, actually, you know what? This is actually directly connected to this. When I approached Uemura at Ritsumeikon, you know, they had me send this whole proposal to them. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, okay, you know, just show up. You know, I had to go through this vetting process. And when I got in to finally talk to him, he's like, the reason I agreed to talk to you is because you're writing about Kosuge's Jeep, which opens the book.
Oh,
it's about the tin toy Jeep. And he's like, I used to play with that thing all the time in Kyoto. Me and my friends would race this thing at the shrine. We'd be like racing them together. And he's like, I never thought I'd ever even think about this thing again. That's like 70 years ago. And here's this foreigner writing about it now. So I had to talk. And so actually a That's huge cool. chunk of our conversation, more than I actually wanted, was about Coaster Case Jeep. Right. You know, but it was actually really cool. And I actually ended up telling the museum where in Otsu, which is the city kind of over from Kyoto, which is where Coaster Case Jeep was made, telling them about that. And they're like, wow, the guy who made the Famicom played with Coaster Case Jeep. Cool. It's like this kind of connection that got made. So that was really cool because it was just an amazing moment.
That whole story about the Jeep and the toys was, you know, was really fascinating to me because, you know, I, as someone who you know, live and breathe games my whole life, you know, that was kind of one of my initial reasons for fascination with Japan. I know a whole lot about games, but I never really was super fascinated with toys and other things, or not to the level that I went deep on them. And so even learning stuff like that was super fascinating from that toy angle, because it's just a really interesting story, especially with the war and everything that was going on. But then also, like, there's parallels I see in the sort of rise and fall of these products that are not, you know, they're very similar to success stories in video games as well, where like a hot product that, you know, was maybe not expected to do big, but had just a lot of love and care and like craftsmanship put into it, it suddenly blew up, and then suddenly blew up across the world too. Yes. And that I think got me super interested in the concept of this book as a whole, because it's like, there's a lot, if you're a video game fan like we are, there's also a lot to learn just about how those connections to Japan came to be, I feel like. And that was fascinating to see.
Well, as far as the Japanese market is concerned, video games are toys. Like, obviously, you know, we understand that it's become a culture. It's kind of exceeded just a plaything. It's actually kind of like a lifestyle and an identity for a lot of people in ways better and worse. But basically speaking, it's a toy. And they came out of the toy industry. So, you know, understanding that. And it's interesting. I actually am the opposite of you. I got interested in Japan almost purely through toys. Robot toys.
Right.
Kaiju, you know, toys. Godzilla, Ultraman, all of that kind of stuff. And for me, games were a sort of secondary thing that I loved very much, but was just different. So it was cool to be able to kind of synthesize those things together in the book, because I think the pull that Japan has, this kind of cultural gravity, as an academic might put it, is, we can all agree, is about more than any one thing. Right?
For sure.
Right.
It's not just game. Because, I'm sure you probably have an action figure or something in your house somewhere. I'm sure you watched an episode of Voltron. You know what Hello Kitty
look
is.
Closely in the background of Voltron's, I think you can see.
Yes.
No figures to see here.
Is this like the 40-year-old virgin? I think we all wish we were 40.
One thing on that note that I found really interesting from the start of the book was that this is not a new thing. Like, you have some quotes from, like, diplomats in the 19th century.
Like 60s. They're like, the Japanese and their crazy zany toys.
And I was like, wow. That, and so, like, to me, I thought that was purely like a post, you know, World War II thing. And there were probably all kinds of different reasons for that. But like, you know, the notion, one of the first things that really interested me in Japan is when I saw adults reading, you know, quote unquote comic books. And this is back when I'm in like grade school. And, you know, some of the most popular trade weeklies are like comic books. And they're like, wait, what? Like, what going on? And then, you know, you see anime and you see things with adult themes and things like that. And it's like, huh, interesting. And that totally, I think, followed through on games and like the birth of games, which was, hey, this is like an adult pursuit that you can have. Yes. And like pursuing this with the same artistic zeal that the guy who makes, you know, teacups, who just makes teacups for 60 years of his life, pursues it with, you can absolutely see that in some of those early games.
Japan is a country, I think, that really values childhood and, you know, childish innocence, and doesn't see it as being transgressive to get in touch with your inner child. Like, you know, obviously if you're at work and like parading around in like, you know, a onesie or something like that, we're not talking about that.
So
you guys don't wear the onesie in the office, wear it at home when nobody's around. But you know, one of my favorite quotes in the book is that an educator, I guess, he's like a professor who's visiting Japan in like the 1800s. And he's like, you know, these grown adults are engaging in amusements, which we put aside with our pinwheels, our pinafores.
Ice creams.
Exactly. And what they're doing is, like, they're flying kites and, like, spinning tops. It's like, oh, my God. You know, like, by a modern standpoint, this guy's brain would really be blown if he saw what adults were doing in, like, the 21st century.
Right.
You know, kidding.
I honestly don't really feel like my hobbies have changed that much since I was 15.
Right.
And I think that's probably true of most Japanese adults too, you know, or certainly large numbers of them. And anyway, that sense of play is precisely why I wanted to focus on these, you know, what I call inessentials in the book, because I think most of us abroad, you know, are interfaced with Japan through these, you know, playful things.
Yeah.
There's certainly the things that stick with us the most. Like, I don't really remember very much about the first Honda that my, you know, that I rode in or something like that, but I can instantly recall what my first Walkman looked like and felt like, you know, or the first time I picked up a Nintendo controller and thought, wow, this is so much better than that effing Atari 2600 that I suffered through for all of my single digit years. You know, it was revelatory. So that's why I wanted to focus on this kind of stuff in the book. And it's bigger than just play.
Right.
You know, it really did change the narrative of how we all live our lives.
So why write this now, or what led you? I mean, in a lot of ways, having known you for a while now, like, this book seems like a total natural culmination of the game stuff you do, but also the toy stuff, movie stuff, culture stuff that you've been interested in. But
yeah.
What was it? And you've written a lot of other books, Japan related books. You have your attack
series.
Yeah,
we had done deep dives like Yokai Attack and, like, you know, Ninja Attack and stuff like that. And those are really cool and really fun to do. But, you know, honestly, one of the big reasons this book came about was there wasn't anything else out there like it. Mm. There's a lot of academic books dealing with, like, soft power, and, like, most of them tend to focus on the economic aspect of it and, like, you know,
right,
your currency flows and unemployment rates and stuff. And, like, those are important, you know, but they don't really tell the story as we know it, which is through the cool stuff Japan makes.
Right.
You know, and there's really, like, there's a great book about anime. There's a great book about, you know, the Walkman or Sony. There's a great book about Hello Kitty, but, like,
to connect the dots.
Yeah. I'd never seen anything out there that connected the dots. And, you know, I, like, a lot of us here, like, I, you know, I speak Japanese. I came here, I learned Japanese. Like, I wanted to kind of put those skills and my eyes and my kind of tastes kind of to work for the reader. Mm-hmm. It's not easy for the average person, even if you're, like, the most diehard Nintendo fan, to track down, you know, Uemura-san and then have a conversation with him. So, like, I wanted to kind of be a spirit medium, you know, seriously, for the reader, and kind of try to lend them my eyes and ears and tongue.
So how did you make your list of, you must have had a big list of topics and then whittled it down or whatever, but what was your, was it using your three in criteria? Yeah,
the three ins are really, and so what I ended up doing to define what's in the book, I came up with this criteria called the three ins. It had to be inessential, you know, so it couldn't be a car or a food, because you need cars to get around, especially in America, and foods, obviously, you need to live. So it had to be inessential. It had to be it had to be inescapable, meaning it was ubiquitous. It had become such a hit that you couldn't avoid it. Like, there's no way you can really avoid the Walkman or, like, Hello Kitty. They're like, they're just everywhere. And then it had to be influential, and that was the really key one. It had to either change the way we lived our lives or change the way we thought about Japan, or both, which is why, for instance, a VCR isn't in the book, right? Because a VCR was certainly inessential, and they were ubiquitous. They were everywhere. But nobody who bought a VCR is like, wow, Japan's a really cool country. Like, they're watching, like, you know, Airwolf that they recorded, you know, and couldn't get around to watching.
Arnie episodes.
Exactly, you know. And so it didn't really change anybody's mind about Japan. But, like, the Walkman certainly did. You know, it forced people to kind of confront that this country of, like, so-called losers during the war had evolved into this kind of forge of creative electronic devices and things like that. So those three criteria really shaped it. And there were other things I really wanted to write about. Like, for instance, like, I really want to write about cup of noodles and instant ramen, because that's a really interesting story. The people involved in it are really interesting. Or how Japanese whiskey came to dominate, you know, global bars everywhere. But those things are, well, whiskey is inessential, I guess. I mean, it's essential to me. Maybe that's why I didn't include it in the book. But I, you know, I just, foods didn't go in. But yeah, so that was what I used. And once that criteria kind of coalesced, it really became obvious what you had to focus. You had to put the Nintendo Entertainment System. And I think even more importantly, the Game Boy.
Right.
I think actually the Game Boy is the more pivotal invention, as much as I love the Famicom. Or, you know, things like emoji, you know, that really change the way we communicate. Or 4chan, you know. Most people don't even realize 4chan's roots are in Japan, that it was based on Japanese software. And more than that, was based on an entire method of communication that, like, aggrieved Japanese otaku came up with. Little did we know we'd get our own aggrieved otaku community in the West just, like, you know, 5 or 10 years later.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it became pretty clear once the criteria were set. But coming up with that, I mean, it took me a year of back and forth with my agent and talking to a lot of different people and having a lot of conversations to come up with that. It was not easy. It was probably the most painful thing I've ever done, to be honest.
It's interesting talking about this too, because, and it wasn't really till I started reading this book that I kind of, I mean, I don't sit around thinking about this, but it kind of occurred to me, like, one thing I have noticed just having been here, not as long as like you or John, but the last 10 years or so, it seems like the last 4 or 5 years, and the tourism numbers bear this out. It just seems like so many more people are coming to Japan to visit and also to live, but really to visit, and people coming many times a year. And we just always, every weekend, have friends in town, it seemed like that. And it's like, what is driving all this? And the tourism numbers are absolutely going crazy, a lot of it from China. But I have to put together that a lot of it is people like us in our age that grew up experiencing what you talk about in the book, and that it now have disposable income and the wherewithal to travel, that it's finally this, the quote-unquote soft power is sort of starting to pay off in those kind of dividends.
Well, it's just, and that's the thing. It's like pay off in the sense, like the really critical, I never ever use the words cool Japan in the book.
I noticed that. Thank you for not using
that. Like, because I don't believe in that there's any way to harness that. Like everything, almost every product in the book was like the product. It was unplanned. None of the people who made them, this is one of the big takeaways, nobody realized that these things would be as world changing as they were. They were just making the next product. You know?
Dude, I love that I think it was Uemura, was like worried about Sega. Like the Master System came out the same day as the NES, and he was like worried because Sega had a keyboard.
I thought they said it had a keyboard.
Yeah.
It did. In Japan, it did. Yeah. It was the SG-1000 or something. I forget.
I think it was. He just said it was this. I don't know which actually system it was, but yeah, it's really funny. Or like, you know, but then again, once Nintendo got its legs under it, they knew that they'd be able to beat the Atari Lynx, which is like a really colorful, like high tech looking system, with the Game Boy, which is super high tech. So, you know, there's a learning curve there. But like the Sony thought the Walkman was only going to be used by kids, like to study late at night and not bother the parents.
That was fascinating too.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't know that you would have the Walkman, that like that Steve Jobs would have like looked at the iPad and been like, oh yeah, so kids will use this to study.
Exactly.
So they don't bother their parents.
Exactly.
Or
the karaoke machine was originally just thought to be like for elderly dudes to sing Enka ballads, and it was never going to be anything more than that.
You know,
and it wasn't until like young people in a kind of grassroots movement started taking and kind of repurposing these things, sometimes like really disrupting entire marketplaces in the process, that people realized what they had on their hands. So it's like, you know, to me, I really believe that soft power, which is a real thing, is kind of by nature uncontrollable. You know, it's like cool guys don't like act cool, they are cool.
Right.
You know what I mean?
They don't call something cool like project.
You can always tell when somebody's trying to be cool. Versus like, oh my God, this guy is cool. It's like a charisma, right? Yeah. Because what soft power really is like a gross national charisma. That's what it is. And
it
pulls you in, and it's something that makes you just kind of have an affinity for that. And that's the minute you start trying to merchandise that or like, you know, capitalize on it, it's exactly why the Japanese Cool Japan program is such a failure.
Yeah.
You know? The uncoolest people in the world. And like bureaucrats make the world go around, right? Like I respect these career bureaucrats who
they
make
certainly
the Japanese...
do in Japan. Yeah,
that's but it's sure. Like, I mean, you know, when the prime minister is telling you something's cool, it's like it's not
right. Yeah,
like it instantly makes it uncool. So anyway,
So in researching for the book, I'm curious. Like, was there anything? Did anything end up on the cutting room floor? In relation to games, anecdotes, or even whole topics that you just had to kind of let go?
You're working on some book DLC.
I really, really, really wanted to talk more about the rise of Nintendo from a Hanafuda company into a toy company. And I actually wrote a lot on that. And actually, this is another connection. if you recall from the first chapter, Kosuge's Jeep was this tin toy, and then Kosuge went on to become the premier maker of tin toys in the 1950s and 60s, and he made this beautiful Cadillac that became one of Japan's big hit products. It was like a 59 Cadillac, beautifully made. He was working at that time for a company called Marusan that was on the cusp of becoming Japan's biggest toy company, but then they fell on really hard financial times, and their bank is like, we're not going to give you another loan. You're going to have to merge with another company. Talk to this other loser toy company called Nintendo. And so Marusan and Nintendo actually got together, the presidents, and tried to see if their companies would merge. But there was just too much culture shock, and the presidents were too, you know, big personalities. Didn't happen. But I was going to use that to lead into the Nintendo chapter. And Yamauchi is a really interesting guy. I mean,
He's like yanked
out of college before he can graduate because his, you know, his grandfather dies and he has to take over the company. And then he's just like going through every possible permutation of business model you can possibly imagine for this guy. They were even running like love hotels at one point in the 60s. He ran a taxi service. He's like trying to sell like instant rice. It's just like, what is going on here? What is this? And it wasn't until the 70s they kind of hit their stride making toys. But even then, you know, I talked to other toy industry people and they're like, we thought these guys were total also, right? What's a card company doing making toys? We've always been making toys. These guys are a card company, you know? And everybody kind of saw them as this underdog. And Yamauchi is just this guy who won't quit, you know? And he was somebody, though, who was very canny. And when he knew a good thing when he saw it, and when games took off, he's just like all in. All in. Instant pivot. You know, we're gonna go all in on the in the way you can only do when you have like a lone guy running your company, like no board of directors. Or I'm sure there was. I'm sure.
Yeah, did he like famously fire his family members when he joined the company so that no one could compete? Like, yeah, I mean, he was pretty lethal.
He had to clear out. So when he first came on board, basically all of the older employees were really loyal to his grandfather. And we're basically like, we're not going to listen to this, like this fancy pants, like 20-year-old from Tokyo who's just come back from the university. Like, who is this guy? And then, you know, he put up with it for a while. And then finally, he basically, it was like Bloody Sunday, you know, go in there and like get rid of all the dead wood and stuff. But, you know, if he hadn't done that, like they would have just stayed a Hanafuda maker, you know, or a plane card maker, you know?
I'm curious. So this is like not directly related to the book, but I think you probably have a pretty informed opinion on this. So in the Japanese game industry, pretty close to the time, right around like the late aughts, early 2010s, it was kind of widely seen as having, the game industry here was kind of widely seen as having a bit of an identity crisis.
Yeah.
And there was a big thing about, and this is as cell phone games were rising, and it was kind of like, well, can Japan really still compete in dedicated video games? Do they even want to? Do people care about it? Is Japan still really relevant? And that conversation has kind of since disappeared. But I'm curious if you have kind of a perspective on like what happened there, like where did that come out of? And then, you know, did Japan lose its mojo? And if so, like, did they get it back? And how?
I think you guys probably know about this a lot, too. But, you know, I can just speak, first of all, just speaking from my own company's perspective, like the number of console games we've been asked to localize just started rapidly dropping off and being replaced by like mobile games starting around maybe 2015 or so. And like the last big console game we did was like Neo, which is, you know, quite a couple of years ago now. Like, and that was a kind of rare, full, like kind of AAA, AA, I don't know what you call it, title to do. But you know, I think you're going to nod when I say this, but Japan is blessed and cursed with having a market that's big enough to get wealthy on, but it's not, and they can be satisfied with it. Mm-hmm. Right. So like you can literally spend your whole life making games just for the Japanese market and ignore the outside market and make a good life for yourself and have a, you know, your company's going to do okay. And you don't have to worry about abroad. Whereas like if you're, for instance, a Korean company in particular, like you can't just rely on your domestic market. You mm-hmm. have to appeal to markets beyond your borders, which is, I think, a big reason why K-pop has been taking off so much abroad. That, and there's other reasons too. But, you know, like I think that a lot of Japanese companies have kind of lost their ambition to conquer the world. You know, you don't have these like fast charging guys like Yamauchi who's like, you know, fuck it, we're going to take America too, you know, like just, he's just, you know, which is literally, he was just, you know, it was almost like an afterthought to him. He really only cared about the Japanese market, which is why he gave his son-in-law Nintendo mm-hmm. of America, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sony, Akio Morita, who famously lived in America for quite some time to kind of learn its customs because he wanted to conquer this great market. Mm. Like, I think brand America also isn't exactly what it used to be. The kind of, I don't know what you want to say, honor that you would get from making it big in America isn't what it used to be. You know, we're a globalized country, we're a globalized world now in a lot of ways. And I don't think the world revolves around America in the way it used to. I mean, part of that's economics, you know, because we're in our own lost decades right now. And part of it's soft power, which American soft power has really declined for various reasons that we can probably think of over the last 3.5 to 4 years.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that going on too. And also there's the other big thing, which is that those old game consoles like the Sega, the Nintendo, all the consoles were like kind of closed development systems. But, you know, the minute the Xbox came along, anybody with like a PC could start developing, you know, games without having to purchase like ludicrously expensive licenses or hardware. And, you know,
that's a very good point. Yeah.
And, you know, the Xbox is really what blew the doors open for Western developers. And then we could start making our, you know, highly realistic military simulations instead of like, you know, what's Japan making? Katamari Damashi or like, you know, endless monster, like slaughtering and, you know, divvying up body parts to make, you know, lunch or whatever, you know, cooperative game simulations. It's interesting because the games that sell in Japan don't really sell in America and vice versa these days, right? You know, yeah, Monster Hunter?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I would say that just in the last generation that's kind of that was definitely the trend.
Yeah.
But now I think it's gotten where they're more global. Like Japan, you know, Monster Hunter finally cracked the West. The West finally has Ubisoft has games on the cover of Famitsu and stuff like that. It's finally kind of cross-pollinated a bit more, but. So you talked a little about localization, like your game localization stuff. So tell us about that. Fond memories.
So localization. So my first dipping my toes into localization was in the late 90s when I was contacted by a friend by the name Michael House, who I'd met when I was studying abroad in Japan. And he famously did all the subtitles for Anime Ego.
Oh yeah.
Do you remember those guys?
Oh, they were I loved them.
Yeah. Awesome. He was like their key subtitling guy, him and a guy named Shin Kurokawa for many years. But I was working at the time for the US Patent and Trademark Office as a translator, and it's a great job. It taught me a lot about translation, but it's a very kind of drab job. You know, you're just doing patents all day. And like one night I got a call from Tokyo or email or something from Michael saying, I'm screwed. I landed this job. I can't take it. I'm just too busy. Do you want it? And I was like, sure, what is it? And it turned out to be, he's like, do you know a company called Working Designs? And it was a game called Silhouette Mirage.
Yes, of course.
Nice.
Back then, we didn't have Excel files. We got raw code. You had to like kind of grep and like search through the code to find the strings. And there was absolutely no like context of any kind. And I was like, fuck, this is just, I can't make heads or tails of this. So I pulled in my then girlfriend, Hiroko. And we did it together, and that went really well. And then Vic gave us Lunar, Silver Star Story.
Oh, nice. Wow, you worked on Lunar.
and we worked on the remake. Lunar.
We just talked about this a few weeks ago somewhere somehow. But yeah, that was the, because that came out on what was it, like PlayStation and Saturn, I think.
Yeah, it was those are both Saturn games. Those are Saturn games, right? I think. I'm pretty sure. Maybe if Lunar was PlayStation.
I think the one you guys did was on PlayStation. Yeah, it was like the sort of remake of the Sega CD game that had come back.
That's right.
And I had actually, that was actually like a huge moment for me because I had like played the Sega CD game. It was like I cleared it. It was one of the few RPGs I actually cleared all the way through back at that point. And so it was like, wow, I can't believe I've made it this level. But I don't think we ever spoke to Vic on the phone. It was all over email. It was very modern. Oh, wow. And like, it wasn't really tightly managed. Like he just gave us like a bundle of files and said, see you in 6 months or something like that. And, and then we, I remember we turned it back in and there was some issues over like, well, you should have had these files. And I'm like, we didn't get them. And he's like, you should have known, and going back and forth. And it was really odd. And we ended up not working together after that. I still, to this day, I've never met him.
Oh, wow.
Never even exchanged so much as a word with him.
Did you see any of your stuff changed? Any like a Thighmaster jokes? Well,
it was understood from the beginning that we would be giving him that he'd be doing all the rewriting in house, and that we were doing a translation for him to use as a basis because that's just how he worked.
I see. He just wanted a literal translation.
And then that one thing led to, I found like somebody was advertising online that he did localizers on some kind of group. Maybe it was one of those like I don't know. News groups or something like that. I called the person. It turned out to be Jeremy Blaustein. Jeremy at the time had landed Dragon. I think it was called Dragon Warrior 7.
Right.
And
the behemoth, the giant ass game on the PS1.
That team had a lot of people on it.
Million emoji, like the biggest, the most ludicrously sized game you've ever seen. And Jeremy, at the time, there weren't a lot of protocols for localization. And Jeremy basically hired out just as many people as he could to try to get it done quickly. And all of us learned through that process that wasn't really the best way of doing that. So Hiroko and I ended up editing it and like just stitching together all of this stuff. It was it was a nightmare for a variety of reasons, not least of which because it wasn't Square Enix at the time, it was just Enix, insisted on using double byte characters.
Oh, God, I know.
Those wide, it's like basically a Japanese font. And so you could barely get text to fit into the boxes and there was no resizing of boxes.
Having like flashbacks.
Flashbacks. It was brutal stuff. And then, we did a bunch of stuff with him. One of the Tales of Eternia?
Yeah.
One of the early Tales.
He did that game. Yeah.
Yeah. We did Shenmue 2 with him, which I met him for drinks a couple of months back. He's like, we did Shenmue 2? And I was like, Jeremy, yes, we did Shenmue 2. God,
Let me ask you. So when you're localizing Shenmue 2, because we had this conversation at 8-4 on the possibility of doing Shenmue 3.
Right.
Shenmue 1 obviously already exists.
Yes.
Shenmue 1 is localized in a certain way.
Right.
Which, like it or hate it, that's what it is. And Shenmue 2, direct continuation, same hardware, only a couple of years later. Like, do you match what's already there? Or do you throw it out and just say, I'm just going to make this the best?
Nobody was paying attention to anything like that. And I don't mean, this is not a diss of Jeremy. It's a diss of this system back then. I mean, he was assigned, so Jeremy's company, which at the time I think was called Wordbox, was assigned a specific chunk of the game, which dealt with street scenes in Hong Kong and a bunch of like little games you'd play, like little pachinko style games and things like that. And no glossary of any kind, no oversight of any kind. Obviously, we're interfacing with Jeremy. And like, we'd ask Jeremy questions and he's like, shit, I'm not getting an answer. I don't know. We're just gonna have to go for this. And I distinctly remember none of us could figure out what this one character was. Leo is walking around asking about, he's like, I think you read these characters, Boon Boo. And he goes around asking Chinese people what this means. None of us have any idea what it means. So finally, Hiroko and I got so desperate, we went to the Chinese restaurant in our neighborhood, which is run by Hong Kong people. And we kind of explained what the situation was. And they're like, oh, that's Man Mo. That's the god of gangsters and policemen and also of business. Look, there's a shrine to him. Every every Chinese restaurant has a shrine to him. I'm like, man, Jesus, wow, okay, great. And so we're like writing all this down, and I remember like rushing home after we'd had our like, you know, egg foo young and, you know, our, you know, mabo tofu or whatever, and like calling up Jeremy and being like, it's Man Mo. We found out from this Chinese restaurant down the street from our house. And
it was
like adventures in localization back then. Now everything is so set. Like, you know, you have like translation memories, you have, you know, project managers. Wow. Right. You know, it's like glossaries, you know, from previous people who understand that you want to maintain voices or deliberately change them, you know, a vision to approach it. But also you have the tools and like a lot of, you know, people, there's a lot more kind of institutional experience in doing these kind of things. Actually, sure. Now it's kind of become almost a commodity. In ways better and worse, as I'm sure we all know.
Right.
And also, I think most interesting to me for the localization industry is how flooded it's become with young talent. Because
indeed, yeah.
When I first started doing this, you could literally count people who did full-time localization on two hands. There's like Alex Smith, you know, he's a good friend of mine from college. And you know, like people like Richard Honeywood. And I don't even think he was full-time. He was like coding and doing like localization on the side, or like, you know, just there were a few people here and there embedded in game companies. And now it's just like, it seems like every Japanese student, every Japanese language student, every university in the States wants to become a localizer.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, don't do that, man. Don't do it. Don't throw your life away like I did.
Well, it's definitely raised the bar, right? Like the, the your general, like there could be a really good, there was a time where it's like, wow, this is really well localized. Okay. Who was it? It's one of like five people that we all know.
Yeah.
But now it's like, oh, I actually don't know of the person or team that did this. And it's actually really
yeah, great. For sure.
Yeah. You're just constantly, there's a constant, and that's healthy, you know. It would be kind of scary if like a bunch of 60-year-old dudes were still the ones like localizing games because they'd been doing it back in the 90s, you know, or whatever. You know, so like, what imagine Ted Woolsey or something is still localizing, you know, imagine that. He went on to that great localizers, you know, thing in the sky, you know, now he's actually making games, and I guess.
Right.
It is. I saw him follow me on Twitter like in the last year, and I was like, oh my God. Like, first of all, he's on Twitter. Second of all, I still don't know why he followed me. I did meet him back in the day when I was like a nerdy kid who didn't even have a job yet and would go to CES to get like, try to get a job. But like, the fact that this guy is like still in existence and has become sort of like a god in the like localization universe, for better or for worse, but mostly for better. I mean, I think he was a very positive influence.
Yeah.
It's fascinating now that he is like kind of like the godfather, you know? Like,
does he realize that? Does he know that?
I would think so, but you know, he's a very, from what I could see on Twitter and from what I remember when I met him back in the day, he seems like a pretty humble guy.
Sure.
And so he doesn't go around parading it. Like, he doesn't wear the badge. Like, he's not like a guy who did, you know, Chrono Trigger or anything, whatever. But he should. I mean, that's pretty.
But he is the godfather. I mean, because basically before him, you have like, you know, all your bases belong to us. Like, you know, hey, let's get the dude, you know, who took a year of English in college to do this.
Yep.
You know, let's get Tanaka-kun down in, you know, logistics.
Right.
This. You know, a winner is you and all of that. But
it's hard.
Exactly.
So what do you spend, like, besides writing this book, which I'm guessing took up? And I see some New Yorker articles from you every now and then.
We actually do a lot of toy translation, toy localization. We do a lot of work for Bandai and other toy companies, helping them with like, you know, catalog text and things like that. We were doing a lot of manga work there. We did like all of Dorohedoro. There was one year there we did all of Doraemon. That was really crazy.
That was a big deal. That's a huge deal.
Yeah, that was. I wish it were a bigger deal because, like, it basically then they just released it on Kindle in the States and, like, nobody knows it's out. So if you like Doraemon, it's on Kindle on the American store. but yeah, Hiroko and I, and with the help of a lot of other people, some of whom you probably know as game localizers and stuff, we worked on that for a year. So we've been doing lots of other stuff besides games. Like I said, this company to me is like a springboard to do all sorts of fun stuff, you know?
So what is the fun stuff you want to do in the future?
I mean, writing books was something I really wanted to do. And so this has been kind of a dream come true for me. And to be able, like, you know, Hiroko was able to kind of hold the fort down with the localization company while I focused on writing this for basically 2 solid years.
Was
great. And, you know, we were doing work on the side there too, but, you know, localization stuff would still come in. But I always enjoyed writing. And so being able to do it at this professional level has been, you know, a big, you know, dream come true. And also to make it about something I actually like is, you know, double the fun.
Well, the book is absolutely excellent. I bought my own copy. It was not provided by the publisher, so you're getting the unvarnished truth. Don't believe whatever Gabe's opinion is, because
he's got a free copy.
Yes. It's the best book. Gabe, 6 stars.
Quiet. Yeah, give us you the one person who read it cover already.
Yeah, what did you think?
I really dug the like straight post-war. You have a shattered nation of just like, what do we do? And actually, one of the questions I was hoping to ask you was, like, we had this massive economic boom that occurred in Japan that was building from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. And as I was reading it, I just sort of had the thought of like, hey, maybe it's because they don't have to maintain an army to do any of this stuff.
Yeah. But that's part of it. But it's also part of that we were pumping massive amounts of money into the Japanese economy for the Korean War. Mm. I mean, it was blood money. I mean, if you want to call it that, but it's, you know, that's a big reason why Japan's industrial sector got like rebuilt instantly almost after World War II. Mm. You know, I don't think there was any precedent for that. And then once they had like kind of they'd passed kind of a certain, you know, event horizon of factories and stuff, it became kind of a self-sustaining reaction, you know?
And right, because you were saying they were like rummaging through the garbage to find the tin to produce the Kosuge Jeeps.
I mean, in the immediate years after World War II, like there wasn't food. Like, you know, people were eating like rats in the ruins of buildings. Do you know what I mean? And it's like,
I saw Graveyard of the Fireflies.
I was going to say, it's like something out of a movie practically. It's unthinkable. Yeah. You know, and I actually like to kind of reflect back on that, because it's very easy for us now to think of how horrific things are and how terrible they are. And they are terrible. There's a lot of people dying from this, you know, illness that we haven't quite got our, you know, figured out yet. But honestly, I do think we don't have it anywhere nearly as badly as people did right after World War II, when they're living in like the rubble of civilization.
Right.
You know, entire cities are radioactive. You know, like they're dealing with disease and stuff, and they have no support at all. So it's, you know, this isn't to kind of run down the situation we're in right now, which is really horrific.
Oh, yeah. But it's on a scale of which, I mean, there's that chart, you know, if you look at historically, like globally, deaths by year and things like world wars and stuff like that. I mean, there's not to discount, of course, any terrible stuff that happens anywhere.
Sure, of course.
Yeah, it does help every once in a while to keep it in perspective, like generationally, like look at the last 100 years, and like it's almost at a scale that we can't even imagine, right? Like
there were B-29s unleashing payloads of napalm right over Asakusa, right over Tokyo. I mean, that's bad. That's like really, really bad, all right? You know, so having to shelter in place, you know, and not be able to go out to the bars, to me, is not quite on the level of that, right? And so it's just, it was writing this book actually really helped give me perspective about not only how bad things can be, but how it's possible to rebound back from even an unthinkably horrible situation. So, you know, like sometimes people say, oh my God, I found the last chapter about like, you know, 4chan and how online discourse is like,
that was me.
Yeah. Messed up global geopolitics.
I felt bad.
Yeah.
But you know, the point of this isn't that, you know, we're all screwed. The point of this is we're going to have to invent our way out of this. Just like the Japanese did, they had to invent their way out of the problem. And in the so doing, they actually change the way we live, all of us, not just themselves. So what's going to come in the future? I don't know. I mean, that's the big question.
Yeah, that I kind of wanted to ask you about that before we go. Like, so now having looked really pretty closely at the last, you know, 60, 70 years in Japan, and like the Japanese popular culture specifically, but like, any trends or things you're noticing or things you think are going to come back or
well, I don't think Made in Japan is, of course, Made in Japan is always going to be a thing because people like Japanese jeans or Japanese whiskey, and Made in Japan has a sort of cachet to it now. But the idea of Japan manufacturing new trends, I think, is not going to be happening so much because Japan isn't manufacturing much of anything for anybody anymore. They're like an intellectual property sort of powerhouse. They're like a lot of kind of late stage capitalist countries where they've offshored all of the kind of making of stuff. What I think they have really successfully exported, though, is their sensibilities. And so we're going to see a lot of things made abroad that evoke Japanese things. Like Pokemon Go is a big one that I brought up in the book. You know, it's Silicon Valley AR tech, but it didn't take off until they put kawaii Japanese characters in the form of Pokemon on it. You know, another example is, God, man, your iPhone, you know, these iPhones and the Apple products that we use so much. I mean, they're directly descended from Sony products. Like, Steve Jobs is obsessed with Sony.
He loved Sony, yeah.
And tried to make Apple into the Sony of Silicon Valley and succeeded. So that kind of incorporating of Japanese sort of aesthetics and Japanese, it's not a, nobody's saying the iPhone's a Japanese product. It's not. But it certainly incorporates a lot of things that Steve Jobs learned from Japan.
Right.
And I think we're going to be seeing a lot of that. Like the way Hollywood animation looks is deeply influenced by anime these days, especially televised American cartoons, the, you know, comic books and stuff like that. It's all like deeply influenced. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as time goes on.
Yeah, I think it's interesting just playing off the last thing you said. Like I used to be able to, and you still kind of can tell when someone has not grown up with like Japanese sensibilities, like manga and anime, and they try to draw something in like a Japanese style. Yeah. Used to be able to tell that from a mile away, but now I'll see stuff on Twitter that just looks like, yeah, it could have come out of any of the top, you know, Japanese studios or animation or comics, and it'll be somebody from anywhere in the world, and it's just because they've grown up with it now.
Yeah.
To such an
extent. Those, like, all of those silly conventions of anime that didn't make any sense the first time you watched it, like the snot bubble coming out of somebody's nose while they're sleeping, or like the sweat, the bead of sweat coming down somebody's head, or like those kind of theatrical poses, or like, you know, all sorts of things that are just kind of ingrained into us now because we saw so many episodes of Sailor Moon or Cowboy Bebop or, you know, Ghost in the Shell or what have you, or Bleach, Naruto. This is funny. There was actually something circulating on Twitter just today about like, pick your favorite anime out of these top 50 anime shows. I'd only seen like three of them. I grew up on anime. Like I was an anime kid. Now,
yeah. Like there was a huge discussion in our Slack the other day about Dragon Ball Z. And to me,
Dragon Ball Z
was this exotic thing that maybe somebody had a tape of a tape of something that somebody had gone to Japan and recorded off TV or something. But like to have that be such a it's such a ubiquitous thing now. It's just...
Oh, totally. And I think that one of the reasons it's so ubiquitous is because we knew some like powering up and stuff from video games. Like, you know, Dragon Ball inherited it from other anime shows, but like, you know, games were influenced by Dragon Ball, the comic book, you know, and then it becomes this kind of self-fulfilling cycle.
That's a perfect example. I remember doing a voice recording, and this was in the aughts, where we had to describe to people, it was for like, I think the Castlevania fighting game, but you had to describe doing the Dragon Ball, like, powering up, like,
right.
People just were not getting it.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think you could, anybody would get in 10 seconds now. And that's just.
Do the Dragon Ball thing. Run like Naruto. Like Naruto running is like a thing with your arms like behind your back. You know what I mean? Like running. Yeah, totally. And I don't even know that the people who like consume Naruto and do Naruto running on college campuses or what are they doing? It's even make a difference between that and Western entertainment anymore. It's just all part of like our shared, you know, human entertainment heritage. You know what I mean?
That's what we're all about on this podcast, shared entertainment. Exactly. The book is awesome. So Pure Invention. The subtitle is How Japan's Pop Culture Conquered the World.
Yes.
I was reading it on Kindle. It's you could just get it. I just got it on Amazon and had it on my Kindle in a second. There is an audiobook. Who read that? Some famous celebrity read
Samuel L. Jackson. No, I'm just kidding. No, that would be awesome. That would be really, really awesome. No, no, it wasn't anybody. It was William Shatner.
Oh, right.
No, I'm just saying. No, shit, I'm sorry. No, it was actually, it was me. I read it.
I knew it was
I'm not joking this time. I actually did read it.
Wait, who was your first choice, Shatner or Samuel Jackson?
It was actually, I'm going to be brutally honest, I was my first choice. With nonfiction, seriously though, with nonfiction, I mean, of course, if Samuel L. Jackson or like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio, bam, 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 knocking at the door, Matt, I really want to read your book. You know, of course I would have done that, but it's, Leo and I aren't that close, you know, we're a little close. So with nonfiction, it's actually really common that the author reads it. With fiction, that's much less common. You don't want Stephen King reading his book. You want like a voice actor because it's dramatic, but,
I know there's a whole industry for that, for, you know, audiobooks and stuff. But, you know, when you're brought into that, presumably not having a ton of experience, I know you've got some other books and maybe you've done it before, but like when you're coming in and doing that, is there like a, you know, like a like guidelines or like rules, or are you allowed to like, you know, throw in an extra quip here and there or like go off script? Or is it just you purely have to read the words on the page word for word? You know?
In post-COVID, there are no rules. Actually, we had to record in my – most people are recording like in their closets these days. I recorded in my basement. I have this like box I filled with that kind of egg carton looking foam to read into. I'm the author. I can do whatever I want. You know, if you're a voice actor, I think you have to follow it exactly. I actually did make – there were a couple places where it was just really – it just sounded better if I read it a slightly different way, but it's, you know, I don't change the meaning, you know what I mean? But
for sure.
It's pretty much 99% the same thing. It would just be kind of a turn of phrase.
Huh.
But yeah, nice. But it's, you know, it's me. So I'm able to like say it like, but it would be funny that like the director who was in, you know, calling in over Zoom or whatever, would be like, that wasn't the line. And I'm like, mother, this is my book, you know? And,
that's what I was imagining. Like maybe the, you know, the publisher or the director or somebody is just like, you know, nope, do it again, you know, with more feeling or whatever.
Yeah, no. I mean, we did have a little of that. Like, you know, he's like, you're a little too fast or like,
Aerith.
Well, so he was, you know, this guy, he's a veteran voice director. He's not into like Japanese pop culture or anything at all. He's like an audiobook director. So he couldn't give me any feedback on that. But we were like, I called Alex Smith. Alex, is it Aerith or Aerith? So we went with Aerith. Aerith. Okay. I think he actually said Aerith, and I ended up going with, like so many conversations with Alex. He says something, and I just do the exact opposite. but I can't remember what he said, but we all settled on Aerith.
That's what it was in the old back then. I mean, now it's Aerith with the TH. Right. So you know, you kind of can't be wrong. You're either the current or you're the way it was then. Either way, so in context, Aerith makes sense.
Oh, on the internet, you're always wrong. I'm sure I'll take some flack for this somewhere. But anyway, thanks for reading, guys, and thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No, I'm super excited to go back and check out the other chapters.
Please.
So thanks for being on the show. Where can people find you who want to know more about you or the book or All Japan?
I have a website, mattalt.com. And there's my on Twitter, I'm matt_alt. Matt_alt. It's at mark @matt_alt on Instagram. I'm alt Matt Alt. And I'm here all night, people. So just, you know, keep the call coming in. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not here all night. I'm an old
Anything
man.
Else you want to plug besides the book? Any other recent stuff that you've
This is my life right now. And this is going to be my life for quite some time because we can't get out and do any other kind of promotional things. You know, I was supposed to go on a triumphant kind of like book tour. You know what I mean? I was supposed to be going like on TV shows and stuff, but
that's a bummer, man. I have another friend who's an author who released his book too. And it's the same case. It's if people think this sounds interesting or whatever, they should absolutely
thank you.
Support the work and support Matt.
Yeah. It's first world problems, man. You know, having a book you can't promote is nothing compared to like an actual pandemic and like, you know, social, you know, upheaval and things like that. So it's,
we make a podcast about complaining about frivolous shit. So relative to the shit that we normally complain about, you have plenty of reason to complain. So don't feel shy about it on this podcast.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I'll come back on next time and make it all about complaining. How does that sound?
Perfect.
Perfect.
Okay, great. Thanks, Shamia.
So until 2 weeks from now, who wants to tell people where all they can find the rest of us?
Sure. I'm getting worse at this every time. We need Dermot back. But we are on the interwebs at 8-4.jp, second home on giantbomb.com. We're on Facebook. You can leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes and all those fun places. We're also on Twitter, 84play. I am also on Twitter myself. I am John TV. Mark, where can they find you?
I'm at Mark MacD and Gobbin.
You still haven't made Twitter.
Twitter. You still haven't gotten a public Twitter account.
No, but if you want to hear more, if you want to hear more about pure invention from Matt Ault, you can follow him at Matt_Ault on Twitter.
Wait, but Dave, thank you. You're abdicating your responsibility to let people interact with you, especially since it's your 30th birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday.
Do you Saturday.
Close enough.
Yeah.
As you remember 30. I remember that.
Thank you.
Right?
Gabe, do you want to give out the URL to your Zoom party? We kind of promised it.
Did we promise it? I don't know. I feel that.
I'll do that later.
We'll put it in the show notes.
I'll tweet it in the A4 account.
Sure.
But Saturday night Japan time, so that'd be what? It's Saturday morning U.S. time, Saturday afternoon Europe.
Yeah, like.
Okay.
8 p.m. Japan. You do the math.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thanks again for showing up. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And, Matt, we have a little tradition here where we have somebody have kind of like the final say. We also have a tradition of telling people about this about 10 seconds before we ask them to do it. So with that, why don't you take us out?
Please buy my book.
Your invention, folks. Your invention.
Thanks for having me on. Seriously, this has been a blast. We need to do this more often.
Yeah. Anytime you have a book, come on.
Okay, great. Talk to you guys in 5 years. Great. Okay. No, seriously, thanks. It's been a blast.
The lazy man's Persian, that's what they call these guys, but I tell you what, I've shown a couple of them, I never bred them, but they're not as easy to present as you might think. They're not entirely lazy. This is the medium length coat that we look for. Look how lush and plush it is. Notice how it snaps back into place. That's the correct texture that we look for in the exotic. If it were incorrect, it would stand, and it would be much too long. This is a beautiful coat. He has phenomenal Persian type bone, even in breadth from the shoulders to the hips. Like the Persian, we want a round, massive head with a short nose, well-developed muzzle, and look at that eye color. It is drop-dead gorgeous. Nice round eye, beautifully positioned in the face, nice symmetry, good and broad. This gorgeous brand was our best, whatever he is. 2pushesacats.com